Supreme Commander, it's good to see you. A safe journey, I trust.
Nothing is safe anymore. You've heard, of course, that there have been two attempts on my life.
I have. I was very concerned.
I consider Blake to be responsible. Oh, not personally, of course. But stories of his exploits are still circulating. They excite people. The fact that he is still free gives them hope, and that is dangerous, Travis. Hope is very dangerous.
This is Bristol. It's Good Friday, it's 5 o'clock, and welcome to Not the BCFM Politics Show, the 18th of April 2025. Streaming nearly live from a corner of freedom close to the city centre in Bristol, another Templar port in Tampon Charlie's Empire of Lies. We're live on the talkradio.org.uk stream, DJ Plug Radio in Nuneaton, Warwickshire, and live on the Not the BCFM Politics Show app, available free from APK Pure, Apple App Store, but not from the evil Google Play. Easiest thing to do is just find the little splodge, the green one, that says download. Just underneath there, you've got a page put up there by the developer where you can find all the latest versions. And there is a new version out, which brings you all of the stuff from the new GreenNet website. I'm Tony Gosling. Thanks for turning off the psycho in the corner, gaslighting us with its zero-trust agenda psyops, bending our minds with sophisticated distortions, boring us to tears with irrelevant distractions, and occasionally a little bit of truth, eh? Puff pieces on the conspirators and hatchet jobs mainly, though, on the heroes. McCarthyite witch hunts going after anyone with influence who speaks up for humanity or against the rentiers. World War III or wage slavery? For those with eyes to see and ears to hear, those so-called solutions to multiplying crises, Gaza, Ukraine, COVID, bins in Birmingham, God, it just goes on and on, doesn't it? The twisted Armageddonist accelerationist policies are crafted, in case you hadn't noticed, to make every crisis worse. And the politicians have nothing to say. Nick Land's techno-behaviourist dark enlightenment cowards and control freaks want us as slaves to their AI, or dead. Albert Pike's World War III curse relies on blind obedience, and meanwhile, wife-murdering pantheist West King Tampon Charlie and the vampire queen Carmilla wage war on China, Russia and the BRICS, as well as on the British people. The Crown prosecutes us for praying, and the only right they seem interested in is our so-called right to kill ourselves, with the help, like the jabs, of a doctor. But it's not the end of the world. Or is it? They sure seem to be going for it. As we learn, you learn. Anyway, I'm on my own this week. No Martin Summers. And that actually is recorded this just before broadcast on Good Friday. Today we'll be looking at nuclear stuff. I've got a super interview, an update with Roland Perry from Australia, recorded night before last from his book about Victor Rothschild, which is called The Fifth Man, where he explains a bit about Anthony Blunt, that he was George V's bastard child, and that's why he was being looked after, and he never got sent over to the Soviet Union. But shows you a lot about what goes on within the royal family, doesn't it? And we start this week, though, with a look at water. Living water, that's the stuff, we like it, but they don't, and they're privatising everything like that. In fact, water is easily available all over the place, and it's pure and it's gorgeous. But they're taking this need for water and they're jacking the price up massively, refinancing. But anyway, you know that, I know that. But what is not being told is that all this growth is coming from massively making us pay more for the things we basically need. Now, after the war, everyone knew that's the opposite of what you should do. You make everything that you need really cheap. You supply it at cost. But now, because they're not making anything, they just take all their basic needs and jack them up. So they're driving us all into debt, boiling frogs at the same time. So we're going to hear, first of all, from Joy Warren, I spoke to earlier this week, about some new legal case in the United States, which has proved that fluoride in the water reduces your IQ as a youngster by roughly 5 points. And also the attempt to get fluoride into the water in Newcastle and all of the nasty, undemocratic, fascistic things that they've been doing to force Newcastle people to have fluoride.
In America, for 7 years, there has been a federal court case running in San Francisco. The judge has been incredibly patient. There are lots of witnesses, expert witnesses from both sides. The side that we were challenging was the Environmental Protection Agency, which refused to listen to a petition by anti-fluoridation groups. So the EPA got taken to court, as it were. In September last year, the judge finally made his pronouncement. Having read the National Toxicology Program report, which ran into pages and pages and pages, the report was a review, a systematic review, which looked at how there's a strong, strong correlation between a reduction in IQ and exposure to fluoride in the womb and when an infant is given fluoridated baby formula, or I should say baby formula made up with fluoridated tap water. We're talking about a reduction of 5 IQ points, which is not insignificant. It is significant, because that would make very, very bright children not quite so bright. But at the other end of the spectrum, the children who are not exactly clever would be special educational needs. And that's going to cost the government, all the local education authorities, lots of money in special education provision. The judge said in his ruling that at levels of fluoride in the American water, which is 0.7 average, fluoride poses an unreasonable risk to the health and IQ of children. That was September. The EPA had a chance to appeal. They're still humming and hawing about it, not quite sure. But a wonderful thing has happened recently, of course, is that the new Secretary for Health and Human Services in America is dead against fluoridation. And therefore, he is pushing very hard to try and get the EPA not to appeal.
So this is RFK Jr. you're talking about.
Yes, indeed.
Well, okay, so, I mean, you've just given one example there. Are there any from the UK where we can show that British people have been harmed by fluoride?
Yes, as I mentioned earlier, hypothyroidism is almost double in West Midlands compared to Greater Manchester, which is not fluoridated. We know that a review... worldwide review of diabetes 2 shows that fluoride, which is an endocrine disruptor, so you have to think of how glucose is not converted into not so dangerous products in the bloodstream by insulin from the pancreas. So we know that the endocrine system glands are affected. That's diabetes. Then we've got fractured bones, especially the hip, the neck of the femur, where we saw a Swedish study in 2021, where it showed that there was 50% more fracture in Swedish women who had drunk natural fluoride water all their lives, compared to parts of Sweden which were not. Did not have fluoride in the drinking water.
What you're describing is an absolutely diabolical misuse of so-called public bodies to poison people, really. What do you think is actually really behind all this? I mean, it just sounds like somebody has either got it very, very wrong, or actually there's some sort of malice involved here.
Well, they got it wrong right from the start in America in 1948, when the Aluminium Company of America wanted to get rid of its waste and couldn't because it was too expensive. So it was hanging around doing no good. And a lot of things coalesced around that time. And they came up with a wonderful idea. Well, we can't treat it to make it neutralised. Let's put it in the drinking water, drip by drip by drip. It's not going to kill anybody like that, but it's a good way of getting rid of it. And they go into the sea eventually. We can't put it in the sea because we're not allowed to by international law. But we just drip, drip, drip it in. It shouldn't cause any problems whatsoever. And they then came up with a great idea that, oh, didn't you know that Texas teeth are really resistant to decay? And they've got a lot of natural fluoride in their drinking water. So if you give it to children who are at risk of dental decay, then that will stop the decay.
So fluoride is a byproduct of the aluminium manufacturing, is it?
and phosphate manufacturing. These days it's mostly phosphates. In fact, what we have in this country coming in from the Negev Desert is from a phosphate factory.
With all this information, why is it, do you think, that politicians like Sir Ivan Lawrence, the few and far between, in fact, we don't seem to have any now, that are taking this up at all?
It is very difficult. They're all under the whip. Even my MP, I just can't get through to her. She won't reply to my letters now on fluoridation. Yeah, there are several reasons why I think this is such a stubborn policy which will not lie down. Both the Labour Party and the Conservatives are in favour. It is not in their manifestos. It is a policy which seems to have evolved. I think possibly it's the people behind the scenes, the establishment, who are much in favour of fluoridation for reasons of their own. They are permanent civil servants, and they continue, they perpetuate the policy through each government's life. Why they do it? Do they really think it's helping teeth? I don't think they think it's helping teeth. There's another reason. I mean, yeah, I'll come clean on this. I have no problem. I mean, no longer am I regarded as being a conspiracy theorist. Now we've got this judge's ruling in America, which has conclusively shown that IQ is reduced by exposure to fluoride when the child is in the womb or when drinking fluoridated formula. There's a lot to do with the fear of world governments about the expanding population. And if they hit upon a scheme which reduces our fecundity, then that's all to the good. It means you don't have quite so many babies.
What you're saying here kind of chimes in with my knowledge of the mass media, having worked in it and seen the way that it's changed over the last, well, should we say 40, 50 years, is that there's also an enormous amount of dumbing down goes on there, where you have so-called experts, and if you go to websites like, say, Spinwatch, Powerbase, places like that, you can see these experts are not really experts. They're paid by a certain industry. They're lobbyists, really. And so quite often when you see a head pop up on the TV, what the producer of that programme and the owners of those transmitters are not telling you is that this is somebody who is just spouting off a load of public relations for some corporation somewhere. So, you know, it seems to me there is a definitely within the mass media I've witnessed an enormous amount of dumbing down. So the other thing that they do is they make sure that certain points of view just simply do not get an airing at all. And, you know, I would actually add this whole sort of problem with fluoride to that list. I think maybe if you were to go back to the 70s and the 80s, there may well have been some discussion about this sort of thing, but very little nowadays. So do you think dumbing down is part of it? The idea is just that people are much more easy to manage when they're stupid?
Well, yes, we are dumbed down. I think it's more to do with the fact that fluoride gets into the pineal gland and reduces the expression of melatonin, which helps us to sleep. So if we're all not getting enough sleep, we are dumbed down. But I'm not quite sure if the pineal gland is the centre of the soul or the spirit. I don't think it is. It's just it's a gland which produces melatonin, which doesn't in West Midland people. Fortunately, because I've been clean since 2003, I hope I've got my pineal gland function back.
Well, yeah. So
take for example the publicity for the Northeast water fluoridation public consultation, March to July last year. One newspaper article, which lasted 8 hours. That morning, there was a short article by a local public health professor in the online edition. We didn't see anything in paper form. Northeast, 1.6 million people. The Northern Echo reporter picked it up from GovWire, but he forgot. He didn't see the actual URL for reading the public consultation. So that didn't get published. So, yeah, here we are, guys. We've got a public consultation. Okay. That's it. How do I find out about it? Where is it? Well, it's... we forgot to put the URL on. Because the perpetrators didn't send that particular URL across to GovWire.
Well, this is just ridiculous, isn't it? Yeah. So they don't want people to...
The other thing was that 1.6 million people should have found out about it. Should have, shouldn't they, really? England, apart from the babies. But what the perpetrators did was to email 300 organisations which had a say in this, like, for example, pro-fluoridation organisations, health organisations. They put everybody on that 300 long list of people who would either respond as an organisation or cascade it down to their members.
Hmm. But the actual population didn't hear about it hardly at all.
Correct. We then devised a website, which I'd already started because I suspected this was going to be needed, and that became North East Water Fluoridation Concerns, which is rather good because NEWFC sounds like a football club, so people are going to have a look at it and say, oh, it's a football club. Oh! I'm not quite sure whether it worked or not. But we did a website, and what we did was we dissected the public consultation questionnaire and we gave people the answers to the questions and gave them all the references they needed to quote if they were going to take part. So if anybody did find out about the public consultation, they had it on a plate on how to respond.
Yeah, well, that's brilliant. But, I mean, so what happened with it all? It's going ahead, is it?
Yeah, I mean, there were quite a few people who were against it, but, you know, we're not doing number counting here, are we? We're looking at reasons, and a lot of the reasons had been used in previous public consultation in Southampton, and those issues had been settled, so we're not listening to those reasons again. The whole length of time that public consultation was going, there was so little publicity. People didn't know what's happening. We tried to spread it around a bit, but we're thin on the ground. We've concentrated on a few villages just to see what would happen, and we found that the ones in North Yorkshire, the North Yorkshire borderline with County Durham, which is in fact Rishi Sunak's constituency, 23 villages didn't even know there were collateral damage. They were getting water from Northumbria, not from Yorkshire Water. Nobody had told them. There's a small area up in northeast Cumbria, which is also gets water from Northumbrian water. They didn't know. They weren't told. Nobody was told. It almost is like they expected people to find out about it by osmosis, but it didn't work. No one knew. And there's so very few people responded to the public consultation, which basically was a waste of time because we realised it was a done deal. They were determined. The establishment are determined to fluoridate more of England.
So that's Joy Warren speaking to me earlier this week all about fluoride in Newcastle and over in the States. That court case, fascinating, isn't it? Evidence, you know, this is what they're up to. But also this week I spoke to Catherine Armitage. She spoke to me quite a bit about fluoride too, but and water generally, but that's not what we're going to hear now. We're going to hear a little clip from the chat with Catherine, because she's organising a conference with a few other people down in Exeter next weekend. It's called Council Tax, Do We Pay or Resist? Which the idea is here is take your questions to them. And also that it's lovely that the organisation that she's part of, Catherine, lives up in, I think she said it was Biddeford. And the idea is to get people together, to actually meet face-to-face, get offline, you know, and discuss these things. Because quite a lot of people who are going to be down there next weekend have got experience of actually having, you know, not paying the council tax, and have done quite well, many of them. So let's hear from Catherine Armitage now.
Chris Coverdale himself, many years ago, was actually imprisoned for non-payment of council tax. Apparently now you can't be imprisoned for non-payment, but they send you some extremely threatening letters, and to do this journey, really, I think you either have to be one of those people who puts two fingers up at authority, which is not really my character, or you have to develop nerves of steel. You have to be like, we're living in this system is beginning to look tyrannical. The bills are going up, and you know, where's the money going to come from? And there's people in this country who would find it very difficult to stand up to this. They're you know, they've got families, they've got elderly people they're looking after, they've got a lot of responsibilities. Mm. They simply do not have the time, energy and bandwidth in their lives to do this.
No, so, no, I totally agree. Well, what about, can you just give us some examples of people who've been doing similar things to you in other parts of the country and how they've got on?
Yes, well, there is Richard Vobes, I think himself, he actually did pay, I think he paid 1 year with a bill of exchange, but that actually, I think the next year he tried the same strategy, but it didn't yield the same results. And it may be that somebody who accepted that bill of exchange thinks, boy, this is a really good idea, and accepts it, and then perhaps their superior says, you can't be accepting bills of exchange and promissory notes for council tax. Who knows? We know, you know, I know people in Devon and Cornwall who have been pursuing the same strategy as we have. I also know two people up in London who have, they've actually, they're on the same year as we are, but the London boroughs have come down very, very heavily on them, and with way more threats than we've had in backwater Devon. One is in London Borough of Barmet. She's had charging order put on her property. Another one has had a charging order put on her property. One of these people has her property in a trust, and she has what's called an RX1 restriction, which is a form that you can fill in from the land registry. And your trustees have put a restriction, effectively, or the land registry puts a restriction on the property, so that if a charging order is put on by the council on top of that restriction, the council have to wait. The council, the trustees would have to agree that the property would be sold. All of these events during this last 5 years, what my partner and I have done, we've always gone to where there are people and learnt from each other. We've been, you know, during the lockdowns, we had weekly gatherings in our house to sing kirtan, devotional songs, and people could walk in. They could just come in and join us, because this is how we can overcome this kind of vileness that you're talking about, by being together. And our events, they're the most amazing way to network, to feel empowered, to meet people who are standing up to this tyranny. And that's what we need.
Anyway, can you just wind up by reminding us where this event is, and if people are interested in other events, whereabouts they can find those online?
Yes, sure. So this event is Council Tax, Do We Pay or Resist? Sunday, 27th of April, 9:30 to 4 at Goffin Land, Pinhoe, Exeter, is just off the M5. And the postcode EX49JL. And yes, everybody is welcome. And you can, the only thing is that I think the best thing is the website for sevenconcernedcitizens.co.uk, because that's an easy one to find. And then you'll find the ticket link on that website.
And how much is it?
£12 for a ticket for the day, and we also have lunch, organic lunch for £8, organic soup, roll and brownie, and bring a mug and a folding chair.
Okay, Catherine Armitage, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you. Thank you so much.
So that's Catherine Armitage speaking to me about their rather nice, they're putting together in Exeter next weekend, and they do this sort of thing all over the place. I think it's mainly the southwest, not sure about that, but anyway, I think you have to venture into these things. I would add a note of caution, that you're getting legal advice from a lot of people who may be barrack room lawyers. And I'm not saying actually that going to a solicitor is going to get you any better advice. So, yeah, you have to make these decisions and make sure you are informed. It's a bit like going to see the doctor, isn't it? And we're going to hear from one now, one of the greatest doctors on planet Earth. His name is Dr. Bob Gill. I recorded him a few weeks ago, but we didn't use that on the programme. And I asked him 5 years after the man-made bioweapon global COVID lockdown, what has he learned?
It was well planned. It does all the evidence is pointing to the original virus having gain of function performed on it, either in America or in China. Although there was a worldwide moratorium on gain of function research, it still took place. That might explain why Anthony Fauci has been given a presidential pardon, going back to 2014. So he's beyond sort of accountability now. And the US has been performing sort of biological warfare research for decades. And I believe it was an issue that they had something like 50 labs in Ukraine also working on biological weapons and gain of function research. So less and less people are arguing that this is some sort of conspiratorial thinking. There's more and more evidence. There were Senate committees into the origins of the virus. In fact, Fauci and his colleagues doubled down their efforts to discredit anybody who dared to say this was coming from a lab. And now we know the truth. It did come from a lab. And we can speculate as to why they would do this. I've heard people say there's some sort of Malthusian intent behind the virus and also the vaccination. I have no evidence of that, but I've heard it mentioned. And more recently, I'm coming to learn that not only was the vaccine ineffective with a high side effect rate, well, actually, it seems to be doing longer term damage. There was a recent Yale study which seems to be proposing that a lot of these what were labeled long COVID, i.e. taking a long time to recover from the COVID infection, were actually vaccine-related side effects. So there was a paper published just a few weeks ago saying that there's a whole category of various symptoms which can be put down to a vaccine-related syndrome.
And, before we continue, I think it's useful for if listeners have got loved ones, friends or whatever that have had what they suspect might be related to the vaccine. Is there anything that we know has been related to the COVID jabs at all that will at least give you a clue as to whether or not maybe some sort of side effect may be related to the jabs?
Well, there are various categories. You have inflammatory conditions like myocarditis. You can have clotting problems, so causing heart attacks and strokes. And there's another category of autoimmune disorders and neurological disorders. So there's a broad range of side effects. In fact, Pfizer's own trials mentioned many of these potential side effects, and that's now in the public domain. But what worries me more is there is evidence that the jabs alter how your immune system functions. So your immune system has a limited capacity, and multiple jabs skew the immune system to produce antibodies and detract it away from a very important cancer surveillance element of the immune system. So there is a worry that this may have a knock-on effect in increased cancer rates. So those are sort of main issues of autoimmunity, inflammation, clotting, and potentially a greater risk of cancer over time.
Yeah, so one of the most worrying concerns about all of this, Bob, is the way that the medical profession have been complicit in treatments which may well be, in fact, I think we know they are, detrimental to the patients. And I wonder if there's anything you think that listeners can do to try and make sure that when they're getting medical advice in the future, that they don't get that advice, which is really just coming from a press release from a pharmaceutical company, that it really is independent.
I think it's very difficult because we have regulatory capture. The MRHA, who approves drugs, the people who write the recommendations, NICE and others, National Institute of Clinical Excellence, unfortunately, they all went along with the vaccination drive, the expansion of who it should be given to, the support of mandates, for example. And they haven't actually come clean about how wrong this was. And these regulators are very powerful. They can stop people's careers in their tracks. So we have a problem. Doctors and nurses cannot speak freely because of fear of career damage. And until that changes, it's very difficult to know whether your health professional is just regurgitating a protocol derived from above, or is actually giving you their genuinely held medical belief. I suppose one litmus test might be to ask your doctor their views on the whole COVID jab and see whether they're actually anywhere approaching the reality, or are they still brainwashed with the dominant narrative?
Dr. Bob Gill there, speaking to me about the plandemic from 5 years ago. What did he learn? That's a part of a longer interview, which I'll put up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk, as are all the previous two, with Joy Warren about fluoride and Catherine Armitage about council tax, do we pay or resist, and various other things we were chatting about there. Onto a section now about Donald Trump. Interesting chappy, isn't he? What's going on? Jeffrey Sachs was interviewed by Piers Morgan recently about this, and he is very, very clear about what the United States should be saying. So Trump, of course, is not saying any of this. And much of what we're hearing today on the mainstream press particularly, it is the interesting thing is what we're not hearing. We're not hearing the basic common sense. We're not hearing the good moral values. And Jeffrey Sachs has been doing an absolutely brilliant job, I think, in pointing out what we're not hearing from Trump.
You seem very reliant on accepting Putin's worldview rather than perhaps the stark reality of the barbarism with which he's executed this war.
Yeah, maybe because I know too much about the United States, because the first war in Europe after World War II was the U.S. bombing of Belgrade for 78 days to change borders of a European state. The idea was to break Serbia, to create Kosovo as an enclave, and then to install Bundesdeal, which is the largest NATO base in the Balkans, in the Southwest Balkans. So the U.S. started this under Clinton, we will break the borders. We will illegally bomb another country. We didn't have any U.N. authority. This was a, quote, NATO mission to do that. Then I know the United States went to war repeatedly, illegally, what it did in Afghanistan, and then what it did in Iraq, and then what it did in Syria, which was the Obama administration, especially Obama and Hillary Clinton, tasking the CIA to overthrow Bashar al-Assad, and then what it did with NATO illegally bombing Libya to topple Muammar Gaddafi, and then what it did in Kiev in February 2014. I happened to see some of that with my own eyes. The U.S. overthrew Yanukovych together with right-wing Ukrainian military forces. We overthrew a president. And what's interesting, by the way, is we overthrew Yanukovych the day after the European union representatives had reached an agreement with Yanukovych to have early elections, a government of national unity, and a stand down of both sides. That was agreed. The next thing that happens is the opposition, quote unquote, says, we don't agree. They stormed the government buildings and they deposed Yanukovych. And within hours, the United States says, yes, we support the new government. It didn't say, oh, we had an agreement. That's unconstitutional what you did. So we overthrew a government, contrary to a promise that the European Union had made. And by the way, Russia, the United States, and the EU were parties to that agreement. And the United States, an hour afterwards, backed the coup. Okay, so everyone's got a little bit to answer for. In 2015, the Russians did not say, we want the Donbass back. They said peace should come through negotiations. And negotiations between the ethnic Russians in the east of Ukraine and this new regime in Kiev led to the Minsk II agreement. The Minsk II agreement was voted by the UN Security Council unanimously. It was signed by the government of Ukraine. It was guaranteed explicitly by Germany and France. And you know what? And it's been explained to me in person. It was laughed at inside the U.S. government. This is after the UN Security Council unanimously accepted it. The Ukrainians said, we don't want to give autonomy to the region. Oh, but that's part of the treaty. The U.S. told them, don't worry about it. Angela Merkel explained in Die Zeit, in a notorious interview after the 2022 escalation, she said, oh, you know, we knew that Minsk II was just a holding pattern to give Ukraine time to build its strength. No, Minsk II was a UN Security Council unanimously adopted treaty that was supposed to end the war. So when it comes to who's trustworthy, who to believe, and so forth, I guess my problem, Piers, is I know the United States government. I know it very well. I don't trust them for a moment. I want these two sides actually to sit down in front of the whole world and say, these are the terms. Then the world can judge, because we could get on paper clearly for both sides of the world. We're not going to overthrow governments anymore, the United States needs to say. We accept this agreement, the United States needs to say. Russia needs to say we're not stepping one foot farther than whatever the boundary is actually reached. And NATO's not going to enlarge. And let's put it for the whole world to see. You know, once in a while, treaties actually hold.
Jeffrey Sachs on the Piers Morgan Uncensored programme. And what I think it's great stuff. You know, I love hearing this sort of thing. And well done for Morgan for actually getting people like him. Well, nobody else does. BBC, very few people do. And of course, you might say, oh, he's asking these rude questions. That's his job. His job is to ask awkward questions. The problem is, the government ministers, etc., that come on never get asked any awkward questions, do they? The really awkward ones, like, what about your affiliation with the Trilateral Commission, which was involved in destroying Russia through Gorbachev? And you never hear anyone asking Starmer about that. What about your Jimmy Savile lack of prosecution? Why did you pursue Julian Assange? All these questions should be being asked to senior people, but aren't by the mainstream press, because they're not doing their job, are they? So anyway, that's Jeffrey Sachs. Now, next up is Colonel Douglas McGregor, who's been saying all sorts of interesting things about Mexico and why. Oh, but here he is spending a bit more time looking at the policy to do with Russia. Anyway, McGregor, always good, and here he is speaking recently, a couple of weeks ago, to Tucker Carlson.
If you want this to end, then stop it. You stop supplying it and get our people out of Ukraine. Make it very clear, we're out of this. No more weapons, no more cash, we're finished. The British and the French can't come in and make up for that. Neither can the Germans. So that's all nonsense. You saw this Euro summit. they're going to assemble, what, almost $1 trillion to beef up defense in these countries. Good luck. I don't see that occurring in Europe at all, because the average Europeans are saying, for what? They look at what's happening and they no longer believe this myth. The Russians are coming. The Russians are coming. You know, the Russians are coming. They're going to be on I-95 in northern Jersey tomorrow night. Come on, the Russians are coming.
We have to kill them here. You hear Republicans say this all the time. Crap. Republican senators, really the worst group in the country, in my opinion, short of Antifa. But, you know, it's a really good deal for us because we're killing all these European Christians there, so we don't have to kill them here.
Yeah.
And they say that out loud.
Well, they said that Lyndon Johnson was like, well, if we don't kill them here now in Vietnam, we're going to be fighting them in Los Angeles. So we got to get them now. Come on. That was ridiculous. I heard General Abizaid make the same stupid statement in 2004. Well, we have to kill these Islamist terrorists here in Iraq or we'll be fighting them in our own country. It's all crap. It's the same old set of lies. It's sort of like the perpetual neocon narrative. It's 1936. We all have to band together. There's another Hitlerite on the horizon. You know, this is a standard sort of gruel that is pitched to the American people over and over and over again in the Anglosphere in general, whether it's Great Britain,
Australia.
It's all nonsense. We got to get past this and once and for all bury it. If we really want this to stop, this is not about winning or losing. I think that's another problem. You know, we got to make sure this is a win for the president. A win for the president is an end to this war, period. Number two, what are our interests in Ukraine? Tell me what they are. What are the strategic interests that justify intervention in that country? Time's up. There are none. We've never had any interest in Ukraine whatsoever. We wish them well. We want them to be happy and prosperous. But we have never had any interest in defending them against anybody under any circumstances. We've got to get back to what's rational, not what's emotional. The president just needs to look at this and say, we need to stop this. And he can be a world historical figure if he ends the carnage in Ukraine by simply saying, that's it, we're out, and then turns around to the Middle East and say, stop now. No more mass murder and expulsion of human beings from Gaza or the West Bank or anywhere else. If he's willing to do those things, he's a world historical figure. That's a dramatic sea change in the history, I would say, of the West and probably of the world. But instead, what we get is, oh, we can't do that. We'll look weak. It's sort of the argument that Kissinger made to Nixon. Well, we can't just leave Vietnam. Well, that's exactly what the hell we did, right? We left.
Yeah.
So, no, we got to go into Cambodia to show them that we're strong. How many people did we lose in Cambodia needlessly?
Yeah.
It's the same mentality. Just be honest. This is over. And then tell the Europeans, these are people that we're supposedly allied with, that they need to sit down at the table with Moscow. And we're happy to be there. We'll sponsor it. We'll set them up.
But they've gone so far in the other direction. Like in the UK right now, even Nigel Farage, head of the Reform Party, which I think is the biggest party, doesn't have power, but it's by registration, the biggest party in Britain. And it's the counterbalance both to the, you know, the crazed Labourites and the pathetic castrated Tories. They won't say that we should end the war in Ukraine. Even they won't. I mean, it's like there's nobody. There's no party that I'm aware of in all of Europe with power that will say that.
Well, you said with power. There are plenty of parties out there advocating.
There are.
AfD, the Alternative für Deutschland, is not a far-right party. I hear that all the time. Anything that challenges the status quo is, oh, it's far-right.
Anything Applebaum doesn't want.
It's right. A bunch of nonsense. Yeah, they want an end to this. There's no question about it. None of this ever made sense for Germany under any circumstances.
Well, it destroyed Germany.
Yeah, the Germans have destroyed Germany,
not
the Russians.
Oh, I know.
And the Russians have no interest in destroying Germany. It's the ruling classes in these countries. They're globalist, and they need to be removed. And they will be removed. I'm confident that it will happen. The British have not had a real revolution since Cromwell. but I think they've reached the point now where they very much need a Cromwellian figure to clean house, because the people ruling them are weak and inept.
Do you see any path to that happening?
I don't know. I don't know. I haven't been to Britain for many years.
Really?
No, I have not. I think the last time I was in Britain was 2005.
Don't go. It'll make you too sad.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking to somebody who worships at the altar of English-speaking civilization.
Me too.
And I don't even want to think about it. But I think there are still enough Scots, Welsh, English, and Irish there who will stand up and be counted. I'm cheered up by somebody like Conor McGregor that stands up and defends Irish national culture, identity, language, everything. All of the Europeans need to come to Jesus on this one. They need to come very, very soon. And that doesn't mean they're evil. It means that they're defending the one thing that is worth defending, which is their own country, their own nation, their own society. So I hope that that will happen. We need to do the same thing. And that's why I went down to the border, not because, and again, this has nothing to do whether you love or dislike Mexicans. I'm sorry. Mexicans are fine. That's not the issue.
Everyone likes Mexicans.
Yeah, everybody does.
No one's against Mexicans.
The bottom line, though, is that our border is the soft underbelly of the country. It's a strategic vulnerability. And what exists in Latin America, in Central America, in Mexico is very dangerous to us. And if we don't wake up and start focusing on it, it will ultimately destroy us. How many hundreds of thousands have we lost? 500,000 people to fentanyl poisoning. And somebody says, well, the Chinese, wait a minute. The Chinese ship ingredients. They're mixed down in Mexico. You don't like the fact the Chinese sold the ingredients? Fine. You can ban the Chinese from exporting to the United States. I don't care what you do. Don't go to war with China. The people that are mixing the poison and then mainlining it into the country, they're the cartels in Mexico. And by the way, they have a lot of support here. Their influence reaches right up into DHS all the way to Congress. There are so many people on the payroll, I'm told, after my visit down to the border, it's frightening.
American officials on the payroll of Mexican drug cartels.
Yeah. The other thing, as an example, I said, well, have we stopped everything? And, you know, you talk to sheriffs, and I went down there and talked to a great man, and he's a huge supporter of President Trump, as I am. And I walked into his office, this building, and here's this life-size photograph of Donald Trump pointing at you. I thought it was Trump. I mean, I really did. I said, my God, how'd the president get here ahead of all of us? It was about the same time that Vance and Tulsi and Hegseth went to Eagle Pass. And this was Kinney County, and this was Sheriff Coe. And Sheriff Coe says, oh, things have gotten so much better. You know, that's right. The optics are much better. There are no longer thousands of people marching over the border anymore. But what about the legal ports of entry? The Border Patrol has nothing to do with the legal ports of entry. Those are controlled by police authorities, customs police, and others. And I said, well, what's the problem with the legal ports of entry? Well, most of the drugs and a lot of the human trafficking comes through the legal ports. I said, well, how does that happen? They said, well, if somebody comes up to you and you make normally $3,000 or $4,000 a month, and they say, here's $20,000, let us through. You get through. And that's part of the problem on the border. So I said, well, what do you think needs to happen? And people told me privately, you need to get the U.S. Army on the border. Bring back the regular army and then rotate them.
And the army's not on the border.
No, they just sent a brigade, and that's fine. But we have, I think, 6 or 7 of these brigades of motorized infantry, these light armored vehicles. Put them on the border. We need 40, 50, 60,000 troops down there. We need some aviation brigades down there. Now, they don't all have to stay there forever, but they need to stay there until the barriers are built and the border is secure. And then we need to come up with a system where we periodically rotate units down there to back up the police, back up the Border Patrol. Why? Because the cartels are infinitely better armed than the police and the Border Patrol.
They have Javelin missile systems.
Yes. Yes. They've got unmanned systems. For ISR, for intelligence, surveillance, reconnaissance, they've got armed unmanned systems. And the thing that nobody seems to understand is what happens when we finally stop it. You stop the drugs. You stop the human trafficking along the border. Now, they're going to try and go around you. They'll try to use the coastal waters. And I think the Coast Guard belongs in the United States, not in the South China Sea, not in the Persian Gulf. They belong here, and they're not. They need to bring them back and get them.
We have the Coast Guard in the Persian Gulf?
Yes, yes, absolutely. We got to get them back in.
Whose coast are we guarding?
Well, not ours. Let's be frank. That's the problem. And they're going to try and find other ways. They will fly people up to North America. You know Michael Yon. He's studied all of this.
I know him well, yeah.
He's done great work down there, all these camps that we, the American federal government, has actually helped to fund these non-governmental organizations in order to sponsor millions of people to invade our country and give them phones. You know the routine.
I do.
They're still there. Those camps are still there. Somebody needs to go down and torch those things. In other words, it needs to be scorched earth down there. Get rid of this. And you have to put the army on the border to ensure that these barriers are built and you have truly a secure border. You need the Coast Guard at sea for the same purpose. Now, once that's done, you can ratchet back. However, what happens when the money stops? You're in the cartels. You make billions of dollars every year. Truckloads of, you know, $800,000 in greenbacks go across the border from north to south. What happens when that stops? We'll be at war, Tucker. We'll be at war. These people aren't going to go gently into the night. We're cutting them off.
Once a mother hears her child's heartbeat, she's twice as likely to choose life. That's not a political argument. It's science brought to bear on the most important question of all, which is, will a child be born? One ultrasound costs just $28. That means $5,000 sponsors a day's worth for the entire Preborn Network. Every child is a gift from God, the gift from God, and Preborn needs help to make sure they can realize the potential. They didn't, when the PRI lost, the party that ruled Mexico from the revolution up until Vicente Fox, they had deals with, you know, they had sort of had a stasis. And the second that arrangement collapsed, the country fell in. I mean, they had a more reform-minded government, but the country fell into basically a civil war that it's been in ever since. Right? I mean, the cartels are, and now they run the country.
They run the country, yeah. And of course, we have the problem with arguably 50 million illegals inside the United States, 30 million is what most of the people watching the borders and watching the camps down in Darien in Panama say have come into the country. And we want to deport these people. And absolutely, we need to. It will help us enormously. I mean, how are we paying for their health care? How are we paying for all the things that they want and need? Well, we're printing money. You know, this is a burden on our society, not a benefit. Everybody says, well, that's not true. Their immigrants are a benefit. Legal immigrants can be a benefit. Not these people. They're not a benefit, and they need to go. Well, how do you do that? And historically, when Herbert Hoover directed the removal of 9 million Mexicans after the stock market crashed to open up jobs for Americans. Remember, Americans won't do those jobs? Guess what? When there was no work, they were going to do all of those jobs. And he said, I've got to get these people out before Americans take shots at them because they want their jobs. Okay, he moved 9 million out. FDR moved 3.5 million. Truman moved out over 2 million. Eisenhower moved out another 1.5. How did this happen? Put the army in charge. The United States Army. Supplemented by the police and the National Guard. And they organized it and executed it. We've got to do that. How many of those people are sleeper cells for various terrorist organizations around the world that want to do us harm? Well, I'm sure Tulsi Gabbard can come on here and talk about it. She knows more about it than probably any of us at this point. But I don't know how many, but I know there are a lot. And we should be very concerned about that. And I don't see anybody expressing that concern anywhere. And which is one of the reasons I went down there with some really great people to show me around and explain these things. Now, I want everybody to understand the people that you've got on the border, with very few exceptions, are trying very hard to do the right thing. All these sheriffs are. But they all admit privately that the problem is bigger than they are. And that's why the federal government has to have a role. The federal government also has to have a zone where it can operate. You need at least a mile, mile and a half, 2 miles into the United States where you can take over and arrest people that get through. Right now, you know, we have this big problem with you get into the United States and everything changes. That's got to stop. Excuse me. All of these things are far more important than what is happening today in the Middle East. When I say far more important, I'm saying for us as Americans. I'm not saying that what happens in Gaza is irrelevant. It isn't. It's terrible. What's happening on the West Bank is terrible. We should be doing everything in our power to stop this mass murder. The American people don't see it. They don't hear about it. They don't even hear about what happens to Christians all over the Middle East that are being killed. I mean, the photographs that come to me in a steady stream from people over there are frightening. They're murdering Alawites. They're murdering Orthodox Christians. They're murdering Roman Catholics in Syria. You know, we helped to create this chaos in Syria. So did Netanyahu. At some point, our friend Erdogan needs to come down and restore some measure of order. I think that's inevitable. Somebody's got to take control of that place and run it. It's not going to run itself. But these things are not our things. Does that make sense?
Of course it does. Of course it does. No, our priorities have been hijacked by other countries. And it's distressing because it does seem like the problems that we face now, you know, will determine whether the United States, you know, remains.
Makes it.
Makes it. Yeah, thank you. Nicely right. put. Makes it. So just to bottom line on a couple of issues, do you, how would you rate the likelihood? I mean, it does seem like the president, having run on the promise of peace in Eastern Europe and inserted himself right into the middle of it, being the only person who can bring peace, you know, he kind of has to see this through and likely will. Do you, how hard will it be to get some sort of settlement between Ukraine and Russia?
Well, he has to keep something in mind. You cannot turn around after the American government and all of its agencies have worked tirelessly to kill, maim, murder, harm as many Russians as possible.
Including Putin himself.
Yeah, over the last, what, 3.5 years. So we have to understand that. You can't just flip the switch and say, sorry, we want to be friends now. However much you may want to do that, you can't. You've got to admit this is a catastrophe, and we are mightily responsible. And that's why I would urge the president to do exactly what I said. End all aid to Ukraine. Stop pretending that that government and anything we've done in that country is a positive thing. It's not. Has nothing to do with liberal democracy. Has nothing to do with goodness in any form. What we've done there is terrible. What we need to do is stop it. So stop sending any aid. And then get everybody out, everybody, and then offer to host a conference between, and I would not argue everybody in Europe, but I would certainly argue all of the states that border Russia and Germany, because Germany may not border Russia, but Germany has long-term strategic interests in Russia, as Russia has in Germany. They should all meet in a conference room and agree to a new map with new borders. We don't need to draw those. They need to draw those. And Europeans can do that. They have been around forever. How many times have European borders changed in the last 1,000
They've
years?
They've redrawn some maps over time. I can't even keep up.
Of course.
I mean, try to find, like the map of what's now called Ukraine. How many iterations in the past? Just 100 years.
Too many to even count.
You can't even keep up.
Yeah.
Right.
And you stop this nonsense about, well, you can't trust the Russians. They'll take advantage of them. Come on, this is nonsense. They've lost 100, 120,000 human lives. You really think they want to continue? There's no interest in that at
no.
all. And you know what's really distinguished President Putin from all of his predecessors, I would argue, is his concern for the lives of Russian soldiers. None of his predecessors were ever that concerned about how many lives they lost. You go back to the First World War, and Nicholas II was a good man, But he was willing to accept tremendous losses if he thought he was going to pave the road to victory with Russian dead. That's not Putin. That's not what he wants. Lavrov doesn't want it. The general staff doesn't want it. The population doesn't want it. So we need to stop that nonsense. And that's about as much as we can do. We're not going to overnight cultivate new friendship with them. It's going to take at least a decade, probably two decades, to restore some sort of normalcy to our relationship.
Longer version of that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk later. That's Colonel Doug McGregor speaking to Tucker Carlson about the Mexican cartels, advanced weaponry, all sorts of things in the longer interview. But they're really looking at Trump and, you know, what he could and couldn't do, should and shouldn't do. But finally, the maestro on the Trump tariffs, which is, of course, Michael Hudson. I see that he did a specific interview recently all about money and debt and privatization, which is what I was saying at the start. I mean, this whole idea that through privatization, you're basically privatizing the government. You're getting rid of the government and you're introducing a fascist system. So the bankers, you know, your Rothschilds, etc., your Federal Reserve, people like this, your Bank of England, your BIS, your Mark Carneys, in the BIS over in Switzerland, in Basel, they're in charge. They just run everything through money. And, of course, we're going over, apparently, some sort of digital money now, which will make it even easier for them. So not only are they digitising and privatising nature, they're also digitising and privatising us. So, you know, it should be obvious to everyone now that money, we don't really want it. Money should be there to serve us, and it shouldn't be there to enslave us, and it is being used to enslave us. Most definitely, anybody that speaks out is being plunged into debt. It seems very difficult to actually hang on to your money. As we were hearing from Mark Hollingsworth, you need your crisher, your roof, to protect your money. Otherwise, you're out. So oligarchs or philanthropists, whatever you are, they've got their roofs, but we don't. And what we need is someone in power or something in power or party that understands the oligarchs have got to be pushed out. The thing with this lot is that they, wherever they are in the world, they're very much here too, obviously, with these wonderful, lovely people that all they want to do is help us. They would never miss. Like if you were to take away 95% of their wealth and tax it now, right today, they wouldn't even notice. They'd still keep their big mansion house, but they're drunk on power. They're drunk on money, and that is what they're using. Oh, God, it's awful to say, isn't it? That they've got so much money, all they can get a kick out of is seeing everybody else starving and not having any money. So this is the Schadenfreude that we had back in the Second World War, this hideous, you know, sort of jealousy of people's freedom and actually getting a kick out of. This is the people, it seems, we've propelled into power now in the West using things like the mass media and the Bilderbergers. But anyway, so Michael Hudson here on money and debt and privatisation, because that's really what it's been all about, isn't it? Privatise everything. So when you vote, it doesn't mean a thing.
The problem is not government debt. It's private debt. People who say that the government debt's the problem are people who want to get rid of government and take it over themselves. Is that money is basically a public utility. In prior to Western civilization, money was always kept in the public sector, in the palace sector. And that's because what gives money its value is that governments accept it for paying taxes. Money has always been a product of the government, but in the late 19th century, banking began to be thoroughly privatized and taken out of the hands of any government that controlled it. The banks did two strategies. One was, if you were a global south country, one of the new republics that got independent in the 19th century, they couldn't pay their debts, and so England and France would impose national monetary commissions to take control of the fiscal policy of governments. So government lost their ability to tax and their government to make policy to the foreign financial sector. In the United States, the United States did not have a foreign debt, but the banks replaced the Treasury with the Federal Reserve and a central bank. And the purpose of central banks today in every country is to take control of tax policy, monetary policy, credit creation in the hands of the commercial banks, not in the hands of the government. Well, the advantage of having the government as the creditor, as it was in Mesopotamia in the Bronze Age, is if most debts were owed to the palace ruler could cancel the debts and write them down. But if you have a government without a private sector, then you can't write it down. Look at what happened in Japan. You mentioned Japan. Japan kept lending more and more money to finance the purchase of real estate. And the real estate, housing or an office building, is worth however much a bank would lend to buy it. And the Japanese banks lent so much money that just the real estate around the palace area, the Ginza district, was worth more than the entire state of California. Well, after the Plaza Accord and Japan was obliged to raise its exchange rate, Japan adopted America's neoliberal policy and left all of these debts in place. And so Japan entered a permanent depression by about 1990. That it's never been able to escape from. So Japan is an example of what happens to a country that basically is run to serve the interests of private sector bankers. In China right now, China has the ability to write down the debts because there's not going to be a domestic oligarchy that's going to overthrow it, because the debts are not owed to private sector banks. They're owed to the government, and the government can write down debts that ultimately are owed to itself. You'd also be writing down debts that are owed to a lot of people who borrowed money to create banks to relend. You'd wipe out the creditor class. And the whole idea of Chinese, and also all of Asian development for thousands of years, has been to create a kind of society that is not run by the merchant class or the creditor class. They're sort of at the bottom of the social structure. And Asia's had that, unlike the case of Western civilization. But under U.S. influence and Western civilization in the last century, Asia's been westernized, and it's now fallen into the same debt ethic that somehow all of the debts have to be paid without taking into account what the social consequences of these are. And the social consequences are to move into a chronic decline in living standards, a decline in population. You end up looking at Japan, where if you're a debt-ridden population, family formation falls off, fertility rates fall off, and you end up to be a shrinking economy. Same thing in the Baltic states and the post-Soviet states.
People have been reading your book, Michael, America's Protectionist Takeoff, and are using it as an inspiration for Trump's tariffs. But it is completely different circumstances in the 1800s to today. What do you think about Trump's tariffs?
He's doing the exact opposite of how American protectionism developed. I'm going to be publishing an article on that on my website. I'm working on that just today. The whole idea of protectionism was not simply to have protective tariffs for industry. There was a whole strategy of how you become a successful and prosperous industrial country. For the whole key was what was called the economy of high wages. The economists who designed American protectionist takeoff followed the economy of high wages. That's what they called it. And they said that the high, well-fed, well-educated, healthy, well-clothed, well-housed labor is more productive than pauper labor. So if you're going to have industry that is productive enough to sell the industry of other countries, you have to have a skilled labor force that is productive. Well, you can imagine what a lot of employers said. They said, well, we want to make our profits by not paying labor as much as we charge for the goods that they produce. That's what profits or surplus value is. So the government said, okay, you may not have to pay labor for all of the wages and the living standards that it gets, but we can have the government create a public sector, the internal improvements. We can have the government bear the cost of much of the needs of labor so that employers do not have to pay it. So imagine what happened certainly in Europe as well as America. Education was free and public. You didn't have to pay pay $50,000 a year, you get public education. Public health was important. It was a conservative prime minister in England, Benjamin Disraeli, that said health, everything is health. Wanted to make sure that everybody was healthy because that's more productive. Well, just imagine today, the 18% and rising of America's GDP just goes for health insurance and healthcare. And it's among the worst in the world in terms of performance. The student debt is very high. The common aim of classical economics and from England to the United States was, well, you want to keep housing costs low so that labor can afford to get housing and won't have to insist on wages that are high enough to pay a housing that's bid up on credit for higher and higher housing mortgage debt. So housing costs were kept low. The whole idea of classical value theory was to bring market prices down to the actual cost value. And value, and that value included labor's wages and the profits of industry, because you have to make a profit, and industry used that to reinvest in expanding. But there, over and above the actual cost of production, was land rent, monopoly rent, and financial returns, and as in the fire sector, the finance, insurance, and real estate. So the whole idea of industrial development from Europe to the United States was to prevent a financial sector from developing. And that's why in America, you had the Sherman Antitrust Law in 1890 to prevent monopolies from being formed, to increase the cost of living by creating monopoly goods. And basically, banks were viewed as the mother of trusts. You soon had Teddy Roosevelt become president, and he was leading the trust busters. He was helping break it all up. Well, what Trump wants to do is restore what he called the Gilded Age. The aim of American protectionism was not to create a Gilded Age of very wealthy multimillionaires dominating society. That was considered the failure of the whole economic policy that underlay protectionism. You didn't want a class of idle rich making their money by financial means, by monopoly, and by real estate rents jacking up. You wanted you wanted people to get rich by making factories to produce goods and services to export and to create an industrial society. So what Trump wants to restore in the period in McKinley's era, he was elected in 1896, is everything that went wrong with the American industrial development, not everything that went right with it. What Henry Clay in the 1820s, called the American system that led to industrialization was protective tariffs, internal improvements, in other words, public infrastructure, the Erie Canal, transportation. They said if there's transportation, communication, other basic needs are natural monopolies. And you don't want monopolies to gain power because if they're privatized in private hands, then they're going to raise the prices and make monopoly rents. If the government treats public investment, infrastructure investment, internal improvements, then public investment provided basic services at low prices or even subsidized prices. And so one of the leading protectionists was Simon Patton, the first economics professor at the first business school in America, the Wharton School at the University of Pennsylvania. And Simon Patton said, public infrastructure investment is like a fourth factor of production alongside labor, capital, and land, which isn't really a factor of production. It's a claim on production. You have infrastructure. But the aim of public infrastructure is different from owning land or owning industry and wanting more profits or wages, wanting higher wages. The idea of public infrastructure investment is not to make a profit, but to lower the cost of living and the cost of doing business for the economy so that employers and labor do not have to pay monopoly rents to a rentier class. Well, Trump wants to create, essentially to shift tax, to apply tariffs. His whole tariff policy is saying until 1913, America didn't have an income tax. Most of the money that financed the American government's budget, which was in surplus most of the time, was tariff receipts, along with the sale of land that was grabbed from the Indians, land rights. And so the whole idea was that the tariffs that protected industry were going to essentially finance internal improvements. And when America did and create the income tax in 1913, it only taxed 2% of the people. You didn't have to pay an income tax or file a tax return until you had made so much money that you're in the top 2% of the population. And who were these 2%? They were the bankers, the financiers, the monopolists, and the real estate owners. In other words, the rent recipients, exactly the people that classical economics and the American school said you don't want economic rent. You want to bring prices down to the actual cost of production, and you want to minimize the cost of production by having government provide as much of what people actually need to live on and to exist for nothing. And that way, America can undersell. Well, what Trump wants to do in his tariff policy is accept the whole neoliberal counter-revolution of Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan of privatization. And if you today, you have the Trump administration wanting to get rid of government. How do you get rid of government? You sell it all off to private owners who buy it mainly. They borrow the money to buy it. So once you privatize a public utility, you end up sort of like Thames Water in England. You not only add profits and management fees, but you add all the cost of financing debt. So what happened in Thames Water in England is sort of a monster film of what's happened in the United States and other countries. Thames Water buyers kept borrowing money against their right to charge fees for the water and the protection of sewers and the protection of England's water. They borrowed the money, but they didn't use this to build better sewers or water pipes. They used it simply to pay dividends to themselves dividends and to buy their own stock. Well, that's what happens when you privatize basic utility. That's what happened throughout the United States. That's the Trump plan for privatization. Sell off everything from the national parks, sell off any public housing, turn it into private rental housing, sell off the railroads, sell off any communications in the hand of government. And all of a sudden, you're going to turn what are these natural monopolies that were kept in the public domain, like the post office, so that you could mail letters at cost and turn it into a private monopoly so the buyer can now double or quadruple the price of mail and say, well, what's your alternative? So all of this that Trump is doing is, I wish I had the chart to show you here, to replace the tariff system with, replace the whole growth of the income tax system with tariffs. After 1913, all of the government has been financed basically by taxes, mainly the income and property taxes that it's had. Trump wants to roll it back and get rid of all of the social democratic government reforms since 1913 and go back to the time when the bankers and the industrialists and the real estate owners didn't have to pay any income tax at all. All of the all of the government revenues will be based on tariffs that are paid largely by America's consumers, because Trump has given a list of things that are not going to be charged tariffs on, and things that industry buys, like us, the oil industry will buy special kinds of oil and diesel for its products. Other companies will buy things. He's done exactly the opposite of everything. And I didn't mention in my book that America also, during its industrial takeoff of the late 19th century, encouraged immigration. But immigration was a great source of labor, and that helped provide the labor that did the hard work of construction industry. The immigrant labor has always done most of the construction, not only of buildings, but of roads, and public construction. It was immigrant labor that became the industrial labor force largely. But Trump wants to ban immigrant labor now. And if you don't have immigrant labor doing the manual labor and the hard work and the industrial labor, then how are you going to have a labor force doing any of this? So, again, while pretending to restore the Golden Age, the Gilded Age, when the rich people had more than the whole rest of the economy put together, that's what he wants to restore. And that, of course, is a travesty of the way in which the American system worked and made steered America to become successful. The problem is not government debt. It's private debt. People who say that the government debt's the problem are people who want to get rid of government and take it over themselves. The governments really can't go broke if they have debts in their own currency, because you can always print the debt. For instance, if you have dollar bills in your pocket, that's technically a government debt. But it's a form of government debt that does not bear interest, and nobody expects the government to repay these dollar bills, because if it repaid them, you wouldn't have any more dollar bill money. The government does have debt that's owed to foreign central banks, for instance, that hold their monetary reserves in the form of government debt. But the government debt is so large that it can't be repaid. And the American government says, well, you know, we're not going to repay it. The only way that they can repay it is for the Federal Reserve to simply create the money on a computer and pay the debt. So they can say, all right, you can create it. Governments do not have to borrow in order to finance their business. The Civil War was financed by creating the money. They didn't borrow the money because there wasn't enough money to lend to the North to win the Civil War. The Revolutionary War, how are they going to get the money? You couldn't tax the people, because if you tax them, they wouldn't want a revolution. So they printed the currency that was called continentals. And before that, in the 18th and 17th century, Britain wanted to control the United States and dominate it by not permitting Americans, the colonies, to use their own money. They wanted the colonies to have to borrow from British creditors. And so the colonies wanted to avoid this, because if they couldn't create their money, they had to sell their products, their grain and their other products at low prices that the British merchants would get rich on. So Massachusetts and Pennsylvania printed their own money, the colonial currency money. That was how they funded. Other governments had done the same thing. And none of this money was inflationary as such. There was a wartime inflation in the Civil War just because of the shortages. There was an inflation of the continental currency because the British undertook a counterfeiting campaign to try to destroy the American ability to finance the Revolutionary War against itself. But basically, the Americans limited the creation of money so that it wouldn't be inflationary. Well, right today, governments have a choice. Either you can borrow money from the creditor class and pay them high interest, and it was recently about almost 5%. Well, 5%, if you buy a government bond at 5%, that doubles in about 14 years. So here all you have to do is put your money in government bonds, and you double it in 14 years. It's quadruple it in 28 years, and so on. But the government doesn't have to borrow it, because when you borrow money from the private sector, the private sector doesn't cut back consumption. They just say, okay, we're not going to buy stocks or commercial bonds. We'll buy a government bond. And the government then prints the money to spend into the economy. Well, it doesn't have to borrow to print the money into the economy, nor do other countries like Canada. I have to borrow from Germany or Switzerland, as they did in the 1970s. They can simply print the money, and it has exactly the same effect on inflation and on public spending and on national income. So that essentially is what modern monetary theory teaches. And the governments don't need to go into debt. And if there is a debt problem, they can simply print it to repay it. And nobody expects the government debt to be repaid. The problem is the private debt, because nobody's going to foreclose on the government. You can't foreclose. There's no procedure for that. But you can foreclose on individuals who are in debt. You can foreclose on real estate that's in debt and kick out the homeowner or the landlord. And you can foreclose on corporations and force it into bankruptcy and force it to be sold. If you're in the global majority, it's often sold to a foreign buyer. And debt is a way of prying away industry or forcing governments that own a foreign debt, not in their own currency, to sell off their raw materials, their oil rights, their public infrastructure. So no government should take on a public debt that is not in its own currency. And if they do that, there's no government debt problem. The problem is all private debt. They didn't own debt in their own currency. Greece was owned, was run by an oligarchy that was in charge. And Greece put its faith in a double crosser, the Syriza party. Basically, at the time the debt crisis erupted in February and March, I was there working with them. And at the time, the entire government debt of, I think it was $25 billion, an equivalent of the $25 billion was held in Switzerland in the accounts of Greek tax dodgers or tax evaders that had put the money there. There was something called the Lagarde list, that Christine Lagarde of the International Monetary Fund had a list of all the Greek tax evaders that had their money in Switzerland. And I wanted the Syriza party and Greece to simply seize that tax evader money and come back and use that to pay off the debt. In other words, Greece should have paid the debt by taxing the richest people, but the richest people controlled the party. The Greek Socialist Party was a right-wing reactionist party, sort of like Tony Blair in England. And there were talks with Europe. Europe was all set to write down the debt. They knew that Greece could not pay the debt, that it was an odious debt. But Greece was about to repudiate the debt with European Union understanding. But then President Obama came up and he wrecked the whole system with the most hateful policy of all of his policies. He said a lot of American banks and financial firms have written financial derivatives, and they've bet that the price of these Greece's foreign debt bonds will not go down. And if Greece wipes out the debt and doesn't pay, then the American banks are going to lose all the money that they've made this horse racing bet on. And so he sent Tim Geithner there, the Treasury Secretary, to lobby Europe and say, you've got to crush Greece. You've got to destroy the democracy there. You've got to corrupt the government so that it pays the government, so that our banks won't lose a single penny. Let the Greek population be the losers. I describe all of this in my book, Killing the Host. I have a whole chapter on, I think I have two chapters on Greece, since I was there as a part of the process. And there were vast public demonstrations in Syntagma Square trying to urge don't pay the debts. And all of this was double-crossed by the Greek president at the time. And that led Yanis Varoufakis simply to resign. I think perhaps he could have done something in retrospect even more active just to overthrow the person, but he just resigned in protest. And the result was a coup d'etat by the creditors, that Greece didn't have an ability to have a social revolution there to overthrow the corrupt government that series of Greek governments that had been ruling Greece ever since the colonels had taken over.
Michael Hudson there, good old Michael Hudson, bless him, wrote a very good thing about the Old Testament prophets anti-Semitic. Brilliant, Michael. Michael, you're spot on, mate. Nice one. Anyway, we're going to have a break now, and afterwards we're going to hear a bit more about Israel, that is, particularly on from Roland Perry, but also nukes. There's been an update from Todd Ryder in the States. Fascinating stuff he's been digging out. This guy is like, I mean, you know, in any real normal just world, he would be all over the news. In fact, maybe even in the 1970s, he would have been all over the news, because that's when it worked. And Roland Perry will be talking about the difference between journalism in the 80s and 90s when he was in Fleet Street, and now after the break.
He was in agony when he prayed in Gethsemane. For the price it was to pay seemed too much for him. He contemplated the price to be paid for humanity. And even the Almighty turned his back at him. They used to love to stay with the Master, but now they considered him a disaster. The ones who cried Hosanna, Hosanna, same ones who led him straight to Golgotha. Judas was too quick to betray him. Peter couldn't wait to deny him. The world at large will reject him. Tell me what you wanna do to him. But why didn't the Jews know he's the King of Kings? When even the stars and the kings know he's the King of Kings. The sun and the moon knows his authority, because he told them once and they be standing still. They hung him high, stretched him wide. He hung his head and then he died. But that's not how the story ends. And but the heroes again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose. The Prince of Peace arose. Hallelujah, he arose. Oh yes, oh yes. Jesus Christ, the Son of God.
Sleeping,
why do you seek for the living amongst the dead? Though he died like a lamb, but he's still not dead. Cause even in the grave, he's not over death. Now we have the victory over death. I see an angel of the Lord come down from heaven. He rolled us to the world like a little pebble. For in the King of glory,
Lord, you are strong and mighty.
We are all dead. Where is that victory?
We are all dead.
Where is that sting?
We are all dead.
They hung him high, stretched him wide. He hung his head and then he died. But that's not how the story ends. On the top, the heroes again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, he arose.
When the sun refused to shine upon this awful scene, and humanity has lost hope because all they saw was the cross and its bleeding victim. Their future seemed to be darkened with despair as they watched him laid in the tomb, hands folded on his breast, his eyes shut and his lips seeming forever silent. They watched as a heavy stone was rolled against the entrance of the tomb, and a guard of 100 soldiers around the sepulchre. Permit me to say, Jesus was very dead, but that was not how the story ended. For 3 days later, early Sunday morning, there was a mighty earthquake, for an angel of the Lord has descended from the heavens, his eyes as lightning, and his raiment as white as snow. For the fear of him, the guards did shake and fall down like dead men. Brave soldiers that have never been afraid of human power, taking captives without sword or spear. For the face that they beheld today was not the face of a mortal warrior, but the face of the captain of the Lord's army, the power of his resurrection. They watched as he rolled away the heavy stone, as one who rolled away a tiny pebble, and Jesus stepped out of the grave proclaiming, "Oh, death!
Where is that sting? Oh, way! Where is that victory? Open up your gates and let the King of Glory come on in. Who is the King of Glory? He's the Lord God, strong and mighty. Who is the King of Glory? The
Kings of Glory. The story ends. I'm back of the heroes again.
Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, Yahweh. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, Yahweh. The Prince of Peace arose. Hallelujah, Yahweh. Oh yes, oh yes. Jesus Christ, the Son of God. Oh yes, oh yes. Hallelujah, Yahweh.
Blessed are they which are persecuted for righteousness' sake, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are you when men shall revile you and persecute you and say all manner of evil against you falsely for my sake. Blessed are the poor in spirit, for theirs is the kingdom of heaven. Blessed are they that mourn, for they shall be comforted. Blessed are the meek, for they shall inherit the earth. Blessed are they which do hunger and thirst after righteousness, for they shall be filled. Blessed are the merciful, for they shall obtain mercy. Blessed are the pure in heart, for they shall see God. Blessed are the peacemakers, for they shall be called the children of God. You are the salt of the earth. You are the light of the world. And let your light so shine before men that they may see your good works and glorify your Father which is in heaven. In this manner, therefore, shall you pray. Our Father, who art in heaven.
And it's paving with your guardian eyes so blue.
I'm made to follow about.
That was the last one there. Was Supper's Ready from Genesis and Foxtrot, which is kind of, you know, Peter Gabriel's playing around there, isn't he? I think he's definitely hinting at some kind of, maybe he was a Catholic, I'm not even sure. But anyway, it's a lovely song, and you can hear a similar, another rather good version, but sung by Phil Collins, unfortunately, on Supper's Ready, which is their double album, live album, one of the first records I ever bought. Back in God knows whenever it was, a long, long, long time ago. And what else did we have before that? We had an excerpt from The Greatest Story Ever Told. And the very start was Samsung, S-A-M for mother, S-O-N-G. And that's called The Resurrection Song. So welcome back to Not the BCFM Politics Show. With me, Tony Gosling. No Martin. Hopefully we're seeing him next week. He'll probably be up in Herefordshire at the moment, but we're going to kick off with, I suppose I have to call it the big interview of the week, really, which is with Roland Perry. I'm going to play the whole thing to you now because he's such an interesting guy. He's a lovely bloke as well, and he's just done an update to his book, The Fifth Man. The Fifth Man, he's written loads of stuff. He's also, if you're interested in any of the military history in the Middle East, General Allenby and the Anzacs, taking over the Middle East, kicking out the Ottoman Empire in the First World War. He's also written about that. He always chooses such interesting topics, and he's also done a few novels, as he explains. But so here is the update, really, to The Fifth Man, where he explains some of the new facts he's managed to winkle out. The Fifth Man is significant because of the Cambridge spies, which I think he will explain in a sec, but I maybe better introduce them. That is Burgess, MacLean, Filby and Blunt. Now, Burgess, MacLean and Filby all either escaped to or got asylum over in Soviet Russia. They were all spying for the Russians in London. But the one who they didn't get was Victor Rothschild until after he died. Victor was most definitely spying, as Roland has dug out, right the way through the war. And he explains that his attitude was that, well, my family supplied the money to fight the Anglo-French wars against Napoleon. My family financed the Suez Canal, which was one of the key elements of the British Empire, and therefore I have a right to be involved in creating the State of Israel. So I think we need to understand that all this, there's a lot of attempts to stop people looking into the Rothschilds. Oh, it's anti-Semitic. But they're obviously a very, very powerful family. I'm sure some of them are very nice, but we need to be able to investigate this stuff without fear or favour, as Roland brilliantly does. And, of course, his publisher was Jewish. So let's hand over to Roland to give him a free rein to talk about his updated version of The Fifth Man, amongst many other things we get into.
The name is Roland Perry. I'm an author. I'm on my 42nd book. I jump around the genres. I've done more biography than any other person in the English language, I'm told by my publisher. Of the 42 books, about 18, 19 are biography. I've covered the royals, the presidency, World War One and Two, espionage with The Fifth Man. I'm on my seventh fiction at the moment because fiction allows you to be a little looser without getting away from the facts. And I love the game. I've been in it half a century. And I think I'm getting better. I wouldn't know. Maybe I'm getting worse, Tony. I have no idea.
Look, you're talking there about espionage. Yeah. What about, and also hinting that there's some problems with lawyers along the way of what you can and can't say in a biography.
Yes, well, in regard to The Fifth Man you're talking.
Yes.
Well, it was pretty dicey. I look back now, it's 30 years, and I had the biggest legal report that Pan McMillan has ever had. I got home from a party with a girlfriend and had a bit of red wine. I walked into my apartment, and the fax, it was faxes then, had curled from my study down the stairs into my lounge room. It was about 70 pages long, so I had to answer every question. I didn't change anything. I just answered the questions. So we stood up on that basis, and I made it clear through my publisher to tell Rothschild, who were, it was N.M. Rothschild's, the bankers, lawyers who were dealing with this, on obviously on Tess Rothschild's behalf, I said to tell them that he might go to court. That's my publisher, because they like to sign checks in those days. I don't know if they're still doing it in England, just to get rid of the individual who was suing. But of course, you don't get rid of Rothschild, so there's no, it's, the money isn't the issue. Anyway, I just let them know that I would not be signing any checks. If they tried to sue, I would go to court. And then they backed off. They stopped short of anything at that point. Now, the big issue at that point was whether I had libeled Victor Rothschild's wife. Victor had been dead for 3 years when the book came out, and I had interviewed her on telephone for quite a while, and she went into denial mode over that, which was really stupid of her, because I had a recording. I had an affidavit from a British film director to say that I was in his office interviewing Tess Rothschild. Now, the new book that I'm bringing out now, I've changed the title slightly. It's going to be called The Fifth Man Update, a 30-year update, and it'll be The Rothschilds, The KGB Master Spy, and The Gay Royal Traitor.
Can you put this into context with Victor Rothschild's career and what date you published?
Yes, that's a fascinating one, because I had arguments with, when I was in England over this, I'd be at dinner parties. Oh, no, Rothschild was a banker. He never got near spying. Well, he was a brilliant spy for MI5, and then after the war, MI6. I just want to get one point very clear early on to show where I came in on this. The KGB master spy that I name, in reference, that's Modin. Yuri Ivanovich Modin, who was a mentor, can you believe, for Vladimir Putin, wanted me to meet him. He was a nothing in the mayor's office in St. Petersburg. It was changing from Leningrad then to St. Petersburg. I didn't meet him. But anyway, he was the mentor. Now, the key to this, and this is what everyone should understand, why it's complete rubbish to say they didn't spy on after World War II. All of them were told by the KGB, you can admit that you spied for us up until 1945. That's, you know, very honourable. You're fighting the Nazis. Modin, the master spy, the one who controlled probably 20, but of course the spy ring that got everyone excited was the Cambridge Five, Burgess MacLean, Philby, and so forth. He picked them up when he came to London in 1947. 2 years after the war had finished. This is a vital point to understand. He was their control for the next decade. Well, that's not quite right. He kept on controlling them even though he went back to Moscow. So the furphy about, they were wonderful people, they only spied up until 45, is not true. It's a complete fabrication by the KGB, a brilliant one, of course, because everyone fell for that, and even Philby was saying, well, I stopped spying in 45. Total rubbish. The master control, who was in London for most of that decade, was Modin, and he was stuck there to look after these spies. So that should destroy any of the rubbish that we've heard about them not spying on.
Can you just say something about the Cambridge Ring? Most people would have heard of Burgess, MacLean, Philby, Blunt. And there was a big question, wasn't there, in the 1980s, yep, in the Thatcher era, a kind of battle to find out who was the final one.
Yeah, well, I was well back in the pack in England. I was living in England at the time. I lived there 12 years. And I was a journalist well back in the pack. You know, if they had 100, I was about 97, I would say. But I was determined, like a lot of people, to find out who it was. Now, the luck of the draw for me, whichever way you want to slice it, was that my father died. I had to go back to Australia. I started writing a book for a publisher in Australia there, and they had Spycatcher on their lists, and I was right up to date with everything happening with the Spycatcher book. That's Peter Wright. I got to meet Wright, and I got to meet his manager, and all the files around that case were given to me, a whole box of them, massive 1 meter by 1 meter. And I was given to it because I got on with the publisher, and he was publishing a book of mine about Wilfred Burchard, who was a communist agent during the war, the last three major wars. Now, I had then jumped from 97 till about number 4 in the list, I would say, in terms of comprehension of what was going on. And I was talking to Wright, and I was talking to his manager. This was after Spycatcher came out, and they both admitted, and Wright was the one that countered, that Rothschild had duped him and was the spy. He had been telling everyone that it was Roger Hollis, and that was the premise of Spycatcher, which became a runaway bestseller because Thatcher tried to ban it. And Malcolm Turnbull became Prime Minister of Australia on a false premise that Rothschild had been organised to out Hollis. That was a total misnomer. Rothschild had been behind pushing the attention of everyone following the spy case to say it was this Roger Hollis, who was head of MI5 at one point. Hollis was dead by this stage. When that court case came up in the mid-80s, he was long dead, and he couldn't defend himself. There's no way on earth or heaven that he was a spy for the Russians. But Rothschild managed to push it in that direction and con Peter Wright into it and con Malcolm Turnbull into believing that Rothschild was the one that had done that and that Roger Hollis was an unauthorised disclosure from Prime Minister Thatcher, which was totally untrue.
OK, now, so there's still, Roland, a lot of, amongst certain people, contested about why it was that Thatcher so hated this Spycatcher book. I can remember it well. It was in the news all the time, you know, that we're trying to suppress it. People were flying copies of the book over from Australia. But was it because there were revelations in there? Because he did talk about Victor Rothschild's role, didn't he?
No, it was the major thing about the sales, which, of course, annoyed the hell out of me because I felt I had a much bigger book and better book and more honest book, much more integrity. I mean, I don't think that Peter Wright lacked integrity. It's just he was completely on the wrong train in saying it's Roger Hollis, and that's what Rothschild had done. He had pushed everyone into believing that Hollis was a major spy.
Yeah, now, why did Thatcher hate the book so much? Why did she want to ban it?
Roger Hollis was not a spy, and that was her information internally, and she was not going to have, first of all, she's not going to have anyone saying that one of her top people, or wasn't hers, it was the nation's, because she wasn't Prime Minister in 73 when he died, but she wasn't going to have that. So that was the first factor. The other factors come into play, wanting to ban the book because it was totally inaccurate. And it was also a disclosure from a major operative, a major agent of the British forces, the intelligence forces. Now, those were the two factors that were reason that drove her. And really, I think it was because she didn't win the case. I think that really pushed her out of office, because by the time this was all wrapping up, she was at the end of a tether and was rolled soon after that politically. So I think she went too far, but she felt she was on the right tram by saying, well, we can't have all these spies running around writing books and making millions of pounds. We have to say, no, you can't do it.
Well, you know, and what? There was loads going on in the 1980s. They were revealing the existence of MI5, MI6, GCHQ. A lot of these things up until really the 70s had been top secret. Victor Rothschild was very close to Thatcher.
No, he wasn't. That's not true. He was closer to Heath because Heath made him director of the think tank in the early 70s. But he was never close to Thatcher. And because of his behaviour behind the scenes, she was most suspicious of him. And you might remember in 1985 or 86 it was, she had to make a denial that he was the fifth man on the advice that she had. It was such a cold and an unsympathetic commentary in the Parliament that everyone thought, well, he must be a spy. It really reverberated, although she didn't know, Thatcher didn't really know.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of this episode does give us an idea that the politicians are very low down the food chain when it comes to knowing what's actually going on.
Absolutely. I think, Prime Minister is a brilliant parody of what really happens, and that happens here, it happens in the States, it happens in France. There's no question that the organised bodies that are there for a long time, like the spy services, have much more power because their comprehension. Look what happened to Trump he got completely rolled in his first term because those who wanted to put their oar in. In his second term, he's gone the other way completely and put his own people in to make sure it doesn't happen again with the civil service, with the departments. Now, it's the same everywhere. Those who are in it for 20 years, as a lot of these people are, sometimes 30 years, have much more power than the politicians. And it's very hard for the politicians because they're going to get on top of this stuff. I've been on since 1990. I've done 30 books since this one came out, but I've kept on with it. Now, you know, you don't know whether you're a brilliant individual or you've got an average brain, unless you are a prime minister with enormous intellect that can do everything at all the time, and they can't. You can't keep on top of all this stuff.
No, you can't. And the temptation is to just read from the auto cue, the script that you're being fed by your civil servants and your political advisers. But look, the first interview I did with you about the original version of this book, Roland, you were talking, yes. I remember, about the Victor's role in the creation of the State of Israel, which obviously is quite apposite now.
Yes.
You thought he had a very important role in that. So this is, I suppose, quite controversial as a spy, as he was. So can you just refresh us with that?
Yes. Well, you've got to remember, Rothschild is an incredibly special case. He felt he was himself, and he was, because his grandfather had financed the Suez Canal, they'd financed the Anglo-French Wars in the early 19th century. They were enormously powerful, and he felt he was part of that tradition. And what happened to him, putting it in a nutshell, was he joined in the 1930s with the KGB and all the other bright boys at Cambridge and felt it was his duty and his right to change society because he was that powerful. But he did it behind the scenes much more. And as I've proven in the book and added stuff in the new edition, he took the information to Blunt, to Burgess, to Maclean, all of them, gave them stuff that was passed on to their controls. Now, everyone knew that he was operating for the Russians, but he was never going to be caught in a park or down a dark alley passing information. However, he did go to a lot of the Soviet embassy parties because he was the great Third Baron Rothschild, and he was always there meeting whomever was coming from Russia at that time, or the ambassadors and so forth. So he had enormous power, and he clashed with the head of the KGB, which was Ivan the Terrible Serov, because Serov hated Jews. It was one meeting that Modin told me about at the Soviet embassy, absolutely fascinating. Serov said, "I want to talk to Rothschild." They were all there in their black ties. It was an ambassadorial thing. And so Modin went over to Rothschild, and Rothschild said, "Well, if he wants to talk to me, he can come over to me." And he didn't shake hands with Serov. And Serov was mightily put out because he knew that Rothschild was a big player for them. But Rothschild was not going to bend the knee to one of the grubbier individuals in the Soviet force. I mean, you know, Serov had murdered lots of immigrants after the war, and he was a terrible individual. And he, by the way, it's his diary that was disclosed and published in a very small place in Russia in the 80s, which disclosed the relationship with Rothschild. And MI6 sent me a copy of it, and it was almost in passing, but he showed his distaste for Rothschild, but admitted that he was one of the key agents that they'd had operating in the UK. So that was one of the things that I elaborated on more in the current book. But I want to tell you that the revelation, one of the big revelations in it, there are plenty, is that Tess, I'm very open about the fact that Lady Rothschild was also spying for the Russians. It wasn't as big as her husband, of course, but she definitely was in it. And you have to, I mean, I'm not going to spell it all out here, but when you see it spelled out, you'll understand why I came to that conclusion. It was fairly conclusive. The other thing that I have disclosed, and I can't, it's not substantiated in the way I would like. I didn't have a birth certificate, but Modin said to me, and Michael Whitney Strait, the American member of the spy ring, whom I wrote a biography on called Last of the Cold War Spies, they both said that Blunt was the bastard child of King George V, Now, I couldn't prove this. All I had was the evidence from them passing it on to me. Now, Modin wouldn't tell me that. You know, he wouldn't tell me that unless there was some substance in it. Nor would Michael Whitney Strait have told me. And he was a lover of blunt. And there's another factor that people have got to know. This is making it quite sexy for you. But Modin told me that Blunt had actually had a sexual affair with Tess Rothschild. And everyone goes, oh, no, no, he was gay and she was this and that. Well, no, he was that close to Tess Rothschild. He had an affair with her and he was much closer, that's Blunt, to Tess than he was to Victor, although Victor was the key spy. So all these little things going on behind the scenes are all part of the rich tapestry of everything. And by the way, the Russians were incredibly prurient. They were they just hung on all this relationship thing. They had it over Michael Whitney Strait because he'd had a sexual affair with Blunt. They had it over all of them because they followed their sexual proclivities and it was down on their files, so everyone knew what was happening. It was the way they kept them in check. Apart from the fact they were spying, if that was disclosed in a surreptitious way, their sexual proclivities were part of it. And that's one of the ways they kept them in the web right up until the 70s.
You mentioned at the start, I mean, we're talking about Blunt. He was very much involved with the royal family. Yes. Is the banking world, do you think, closely linked to the intelligence world?
It definitely was with Rothschild because he had the power. I mean, he got you, that's the UK and Australia and the Russians, get that, the Soviets, to vote for the state of Israel. That's how powerful he was. Now, think about that. You can't just tell Stalin or anyone, you know, if you're not someone with enormous power and influence, he got them to back the state of Israel. So that's nothing to do with the banking as such, but he did use the bank for all sorts of activities. And he was very influential in many ways, Rothschild. I think you've got to see it in the context, Tony, of how great the family was. And he felt he was just part of that greatness. He got caught up in the socialism and the communism because he felt it was his duty to change the planet. He didn't think small. He thought, I'm a Rothschild. I'm in a position of power. The British system has to change because it's top-heavy. Very few people control the whole thing and the plebs in the country need a lift. All that stuff was going on in his head. So he felt he was duty-bound as a Rothschild to change all that.
It seems that the whole craft of journalism has changed since you were working in Fleet Street. Would you say you think it's changed or not?
You're asking a tough one. I'm still involved. I mean, I'm on book 42, and I'm going to actually publish that one myself. I don't know at this stage. I've had big publishers up until 41. It changed in the sense of, look, I came out of an era where integrity was the key, you know, getting the facts right, digging hard. I mean, the Rothschild thing I was on for 30 years part-time, only piddly bits every now and again, but it was coming into me all the time. You never give up on it. And I felt that I hadn't really driven it home. And the book did pretty well in England and Australia, but I thought it was going to do better than Spycatcher, naively, because I had the proper story. In fact, it was William Armstrong, the publisher at Pan Macmillan, bought the book and he said, you've explained the entire espionage thing with the Cambridge Five. I didn't mention that in the book at the time because it sounds chest-beating, but I say it in context now. He was the top publisher in this era and he said to me, I'm publishing this because you've explained the whole thing to me. And that was naming Rothschild as the fifth man. So what's changed? I mean, you look at the states, it's just divided. No one cares about the integrity of events. If you're on the Democrat side, you lie, and if you're on the Republican side, you lie for your benefit. No one gets the kernel of what the integrity of events are. It's not happening. Who knows about Trump's relationship with Putin? I don't. I've heard lots of things. I mean, I've been following that for a long time. Someone said he was an asset, which is different from an agent. In other words, it's someone who's conned into supporting a country by inducement, you know, using his property companies and all the rest. There's been no proof of it, but there's been a lot of innuendo and rumour for a long time.
They said the same about Harold Wilson, didn't they?
Yes, they did. I think with Trump, it's very interesting because I followed his pronouncements since the 80s. And one of the things he was very heavy on in the 80s, I'm not talking about last week, was the breakup of NATO. NATO weren't doing enough, right? Now, no one in the West was talking about NATO wasn't doing enough to bolster the European defences against Russia, against the Soviet Union. And here he is saying, and he's still on that mantra. Now, that could have been, I don't want to indict him without real facts, but that could have been a talking point from someone in the KGB who got to him, had a nice lunch with him, said, we're going to invest in one of your towers in Moscow or in New York, and then said, look, there's an issue here. We think that, you know, you should mention this. Why isn't NATO supporting itself rather than the Americans supporting it? So he started that mantra in the 80s. Quite incredible.
Well,
so
this guy you interviewed, Modin, you say he was quite close to Putin. What, how do you see Putin as emerging and developing now?
Putin was a little, he was small fry when I was supposed to meet him. I didn't meet him because my plane had to go. I knocked on the KGB door in Leningrad and the secretary said, no, it wasn't the KGB, it was at the mayor's office. He had a year in the mayor's office there down in Leningrad, and I didn't meet him. My plane had to go. I didn't know. He was a little pipsqueak nothing, but Modin wanted me to meet him. Now, he was a little pipsqueak nothing in the KGB, but he built up his tremendous influence, and of course he has spent the only for a long time, the only departments that got extra money and grew were those under espionage control. In other words, he got the GRU, which was the military, he got the KGB together, he controls, and he's above it all. He's the full dictator in Russia. No one can take him on. And it may be, and I'm not putting Trump in a very bad light here, but I'm saying he admires Putin because he has that control. Look, Trump wants that sort of control, and he can't get it in America. But he admires Putin because he's got it. And so there's where Putin stands. He's totally, he's all-powerful, and it's going to be very hard to assassinate him and get rid of him. And he doesn't want to go, and he won't go. I don't know how it's going to end up, but he's certainly all-powerful at the moment.
We're really here to talk about Viktor Rothschild, aren't we?
And so yeah, sorry.
I know, it's all right, but we ought to focus, I think, on what's been going on in the Middle East. I mean, we've created, the British mainly, and Allenby, and I know you've written about that too, created this kind of crusader state, which is now, I mean, people are pointing at Israel and saying this is basically a nuclear-armed doomsday cult. What the hell are they up to?
Yeah, well, it's fascinating. You've got to put yourself, I always like to put myself in the position of the people who are involved. So you sit there with Netanyahu and they hammer them on the October the 7th, and what, how many? 1,200 died. Now, what does he do? What would your prime minister do when Hamas says, we're going to kill all Jews, we're going to get them? He had a very good excuse to say, well, we will kill you first. We'll knock you off. You won't knock us off. And they are a very powerful client state of America. And they are America's real bolt hole in the Middle East. So that's not going to change overnight. The Americans will back them right through. And they have a very good excuse. I don't think it's an excuse to murder everyone and slaughter people, but they will say, well, Hamas has stated, and they have stated and still stating it, will destroy Israel. Well if you're
on,
in the state
on,
of
because,
Israel.
Because, look, it's the same the other way around, and 1,000 people or so killed in Israel, many of whom it looks as if were actually killed by the IDF as well. You're then saying that you're going to kill 50,000 civilians and you're going to turn the whole...
Now, wait a minute. You're saying it's, sort of... What's the proof? No, Tony, you've just thrown in the IDF. What proofs have you got of that?
There's loads of evidence that the IDF, as they were, like, particularly the tanks hitting kibbutzes where people were being held, and helicopter gunships firing at the festival and things like this, they were killing some Israelis as well as just the Hamas people. So look, I mean, but the point is we've got 50,000 dead now and they're talking about bulldozing Gaza for some sort of American beach resort.
No, that's Trump's idea of a, you know, having a resort situation. That won't happen. That's bizarre. And that's the, you know, the property developer in him saying all that. What disappoints me, and I've been right through the Middle East, right through Transjordan, Saudi, Syria, and so forth for two books, one we're talking about now, also two war books. And I was very disappointed that they haven't, some of those Arab states have not taken refugees from that area. It doesn't mean they have to take them all out, but they haven't taken any. The Egyptians haven't. No one said, well, we'll take a million. No one said it. And that's disappointing to me because it's supposed to be supporting each other, but it doesn't happen that way.
For people who maybe were, you know, millennials, people are only like 20, 30 years old. Why does why does this guy, Victor Rothschild, and his role in MI5 in the Second World War and MI6 in the Cold War, why does it still matter today?
Well, because he was part of the tremendous spy network that is still running today. Now, though, it's a very fascinating question, which I've covered in the book to a degree. I mean, it's another book. I'm not going to do it. Others can do it. But so successful with Moden and Philby that they created a raft, a huge raft of spies that are now, Tony, retiring. They're in their 60s, right? And they're retiring and getting out. I know that. I know some of them are leaving. I've got one contact left in the KGB, as it was. It's the Russian Intelligence Service now. I've got one left. But they've done their duty and they've set up tremendous networks everywhere and they are very influential. So what I'm saying about the Cambridge 5 and the Cambridge 20, there were more than five, but the key ones were, we know, the five. They created the espionage world that is dominating now. It's the Soviet Union that's still the most dominant force. And the Chinese are trying to come second because of their cyber work and their computer work in that direction. But the Russians still are running rings around Western intelligence services. And that's because it was set up by Moden, and Rothschild had a big say in that by covering up, by deflecting, and letting those spies that are in place, you know, they thrived after World War II.
Yeah, but it's a bit like the oil. And of course, if Victor Rothschild and the Russians have got someone right at the top of British intelligence, again, this is a way of totally undermining the state. So anyway, what's the title of your new edition, please, Roland, and where do people get hold of it?
Right, it's on Amazon, Amazon Books you've got to look at. Now, it's not out for a couple of weeks. I've got up the e-version, but it's not. It'll be in audio in a couple of weeks, and you'll be able to buy it in hardcover and paperback. And I know that sounds odd to a lot of people, but if you look at the page, you'll have the audio, you'll have the electronic, and then you'll have hardcover and paperback. I've bought a couple of the previous book I put up there, which was published by a normal publisher, and now I've done it. So that's what happens. And the title will be The Fifth Man, a 30-year update, The Rothschilds, The KGB Master Spy, and The Gay Royal Traitor, which is Blunt. I do quite a lot of work on Blunt's relationship, and while that's going to be a bit of a shock for a lot of people saying it can't be true, if you read my book, you'll see the number of times that Blunt worked for the Royals in special operations right through to the end of his life. That's Blunt's life. He was operating for the Royals. And it's a fascinating link that no one really has gone into, because the royal biographers, basically a bunch of sycophants, have avoided all that and concentrated on Blunt's wonderful career as an art historian. Well, he was a wonderful spy and a very effective one, and he was a royal. Again, I didn't get a birth certificate. I think it's well beyond circumstantial, and other people will pick it up now. But the royal sycophants, the biographers, some of them write very well. No. I won't mention their names.
Well, actually, there's Andrew Morton, isn't it, has written actually quite
a bit. He's a lightweight. Come on, you can't.
No, his thing on Diana was explosive originally. And there's, I think it's so many Carnations or something. He wrote a book which looks at Blunt's role in going over to Germany after the war.
I've had that.
To pinch a load of...
I've published that in two books. That's old hat. He just copied that.
What was Blunt up to over there then?
Well, he was getting all the royal letters, all the evidence of the relationship with King Edward VIII with the Nazis. He was getting there. You've got to remember, this is, again, put it in context. It's 1940s. And they were worried about the image of Queen Victoria. She sent all her letters over to her daughter there.
Roland, we got the First World War, where all these people, this one family, were actually behind the war. It was basically a family squabble. So, of course, there's going to be some correspondence. Should be historically very interesting.
No, we're talking about Victoria's life. I mean, that's one aspect of what Blunt was forced over there. I mean, he did it because he was a royal himself. I think you've got to put it in the context of he was a half-brother to King George VI. He was the son, the bastard son of the fifth, and he was uncle to Queen Elizabeth. That's why he got away with so much right up until Thatcher outed him in 1980, I think, 79, after Andrew Boyle's book came out. They hung on to him because he was one of the family. That's my contention, and far beyond circumstantial.
Roland Perry, thanks very much for joining us again.
Thank you so much.
So that's Roland Perry there, full version of that. So I'll probably put it up on the show page anyway, if you just want to listen to that on its own. There he is talking about his update on the fifth man, that Anthony Blunt was a bastard child of George the Fifth. Oh, dear. I mean, at the time, I suppose that would have been explosive news. But, you know, this stuff does come out. And, okay, he says he's not got the birth certificate. But you know what? He's pretty good, is Roland. I love it when he was talking about the... well, I started off as like 95, and then I've been over to Australia and met Peter Wright, I pretty much knew what was going on in the whole of the country. I came back to London, I was like number four, I think he said, didn't he? So this is how it used to be. I mean, journalism was really a fantastic profession where people would just try and find out what was going on, and they would find it fairly easy to, with a newspaper, a decent editors or television, to share it with the public. But mainly the newspapers, and that's who he worked for. So that's Roland Perry. The context of all of that, really, though, is what's going on right now. So let's have a listen to Sky News' report today, actually. This is a Good Friday report, uncovering new evidence which contradicts Israel's account of the deadly attack on the 18 paramedics. So they're just lying. They're lying and they're lying, and their army is doing what the terrorists have always done, which is to hope that they can kill, murder, maim, do whatever they want. Absolutely disgusting and hideous to paramedics. And they're killing them because they're a part of a genocide. And then they thought they could bury all the evidence. Well, Sky has proven what actually really happened. And, of course, this does not go down well in Israel. This has also triggered the pronouncement from the Board of Deputies of British Jews. Netanyahu's got to leave, hasn't he? He's got to go out and he should be jailed. I mean, in fact, maybe, you know, if it's Jewish law, maybe the guy should be executed. But certainly, this is why he needs to be removed, because he and his friends are all war criminals. What can you do? You've got to go in, you've got to do something. So, let's have a listen now to the Sky News report.
The Israeli military has now admitted to shooting the medical workers, all of whom were unarmed, but they have yet to provide any evidence for their claim that Hamas militants were among those killed. Initially, they said 9 of the rescue workers were militants. About a week later, the IDF revised the number of militants down to 6. But again, they haven't yet provided any information about how they knew that Hamas militants had buried themselves and hidden themselves amongst the paramedics. Sky News has also investigated the social media accounts of all the paramedics involved, and none of them show any obvious affiliation with Hamas. So we asked the Israeli government directly about their claims.
Were they identified as Hamas, these 6 Hamas you've identified? Were they identified before these troops opened fire or after?
So that's why Hamas themselves use ambulances to hide their identity.
Right.
While
it was after.
No, while our soldiers stake out Hamas terror squads, Hamas hides behind civilians and then cries foul when terrorists are targeted. Mark, Israel doesn't fear the truth. That's why we are investigating this incident extremely thoroughly. Can Hamas say the same? Hamas violates every principle of international law. They hide in hospitals, in mosques, in schools, and then they blame us when war crimes blow up in their own faces.
The IDF has said that their initial investigation showed that there was no firing from close distance during the incident. But our audio analysis paints a starkly different picture.
We worked with independent audio forensic experts to analyse the gunfire in the video. Using the time lag between the sound of the bullet and the gun firing, they were able to calculate that the initial gunshots were fired from approximately 50 metres away. The Israeli military has not said any of their forces came under any return fire. By the end of the recording, the analysis tells us that the gunshots were fired from as close as 12 to 18 metres, which suggests the IDF soldiers were closing in. Altogether, the shooting lasted more than 5 minutes. The audio experts confirmed to Sky News that well over 100 rounds were fired in that time. Doctors who reviewed the dead bodies after the attack told us that some individuals had more than 20 gunshot wounds, many to the upper body and head. Sky News spoke to the forensic pathologist who performed the postmortems on the bodies, and he told us about the injuries he saw. Using satellite imagery and video analysis, we were able to recreate the scene of the attack. That's allowed us to plot the positions of each emergency vehicle when the attack began at 5:08. The vehicle that first went missing, Rifat's ambulance, and the others that came to help. Satellite imagery taken at 10:48 the same morning shows that within hours, the IDF had gathered five of the vehicles together on the side of the road and set up roadblocks to the north and south. At least nine IDF vehicles are visible in the area, including what looks like tanks and bulldozers. Satellite imagery taken 2 days later, on the 25th of March at 10:36, shows that the vehicles have been buried beneath a mound of sand. This means that they must have been crushed after being moved to the side of the road. This contradicts the IDF's initial claim that the vehicles were damaged by a large engineering tool as they were moving vehicles off the road. And it corroborates what survivor Munza told us about what the military did after the attack.
We arrived at the site where the ambulances were hit.
The IDF also refused to allow rescue teams to access the site of the attack for at least 5 days because of what they called operational activity. When the rescue teams could finally access the area, they were filmed digging mangled vehicles and dead bodies out of sand piles and placing them in white bags to be transferred to the mortuary.
They were here to save lives. Instead, they ended up in a mass grave. Their vehicles, their ambulances, UN vehicles, civil defense vehicles are crushed and dumped, covered in sand next to us. It's an absolute horror. What has happened here?
Amongst the claims Sky News heard from medics and civil defense workers has been that at least one of the bodies had their hands and feet bound together. Photos and videos obtained by Sky News appear to show the recovered bodies, their Red Crescent logo on the arm of the uniform. But there is no clear evidence of handcuffs or legs tied together. Sources at PRCS and Civil Defence told us that these white tags and ties are commonly used by emergency workers to identify bodies. In the absence of any confirmation from the IDF, it's not clear exactly which of their forces were responsible for the shootings, nor where they were based. But Sky News has uncovered significant clues. Among footage published by the IDF themselves was this photo, taken at approximately 6:45 a.m. Sky News located the building to this abandoned hospital. It's just 1 kilometre east of where the vehicles were attacked. And satellite imagery from the hours after the incident shows dozens of vehicle tracks are visible between the two locations. The IDF has not released details of the soldiers or their battalion involved, but it has said they belong to the elite Golani Brigade. This video, which emerged on the 4th of April, shows a Golani patrol commander speaking to his troops. "We gave the Israeli military the right to reply, and they sent Sky News this response. The IDF is conducting an inquiry into the incident. The preliminary inquiry indicated that the troops opened fire due to a perceived threat following a previous encounter in the area, and that six of the individuals killed in the incident were identified as Hamas terrorists. All the claims raised regarding the incident will be examined in a detailed and thorough manner for a decision on how to handle the event." Serious questions are now being asked in Israel by those at the very highest levels.
The story is more complicated than the original explanation made by the IDF. The original reaction by the Israeli army, and then subsequent corrections made, all points to something very, very disturbing.
The amount of evidence already gathered is unprecedented, especially video footage that documents the events. And human rights lawyers say all this points to a grave violation of human rights and war crimes.
This looks like a dreadful war crime. The availability of a bulldozer to bury the bodies of the 15 people and their vehicles, and the change of official accounts given by Israel, all of which points to cover-up. It's exactly what you would expect of any crime. Evidence of crime, and not the reaction of innocence, but the reaction of cover-up.
These scenes have become horrifyingly familiar over the past 18 months. The killing of medics in Israeli attacks has happened repeatedly. Rifat and his colleagues are among more than 400 aid workers who've been killed here since October the 7th. Hundreds of lives violently cut short in a war that the head of the ICRC believes will haunt us for a long time. All of them should have been protected under humanitarian law.
Allahu Akbar!
What sets their killings apart is their last moments were recorded on video. Now the UN, the EU, their families and colleagues want accountability and justice for their deaths and answers from Israel about why they were killed. Alex Crawford, Sky News.
Horrifying stuff, but well done to Sky. Well done to Sky to getting doing all the forensic there. It's quite funny watching the report on as a video because you see all the kind of audio editing software that we use that they're using to make various proofs in their investigation there. Now, there'll be some investigation being done by the IDF, won't there? But they're not really investigating at all. They're just going to pretend and come up with something that they think and con us with a lie. But anyway, Sky News have done the business on Good Friday. Well done, guys. Congratulations. Next up on Israel, John Bosnich. I spoke to him as a sort of little Easter chit-chat 2025 about, well, I suppose you could call it geopolitics and the occult.
Theodor Herzl, who was the founder of the Zionist movement, or the modern founder of the Zionist movement, was actually not religious, didn't believe in God, and that the Zionist movement, I know a little bit about him because he was born and grew up in the suburb of Belgrade, Serbia, in the Zemun suburb, which was at the time of his birth an occupied territory belonging to Austria before World War I. So indeed, these things are connected. It is not a coincidence that Carney is a bankster. It is not a coincidence that Sunak was a bankster. It is not a coincidence that the Israel lobby put Trump into power. There is something taking place now, and we know that there are people like Netanyahu who are served, whose interests are served by war, because in the state of emergency that they've created, he can stay in office. And this is very similar to the situation in the so-called COVID era, a virus which I caught and which I naturally recovered from with the help of what? Well, the banned substance, ivermectin or ivermectin. This is a pulling of the wool over the world's eyes to a degree that I have never seen in my lifetime, and I don't think have had parallels in modern history. I think they realize that their bankster-driven system is collapsing. I think the discussions about whether or not the gold is really in Fort Knox are legitimate questions, and I think that we may be on the eve of a new era. What that era will be, I don't know, but the old era is collapsing.
Well, I can tell you they've got their plans for the new era. So if you have a look at what the accelerationists are up to, it's very, and these are the tech giants. These are the Yuval Noah Harari, the Dark Enlightenment people, Curtis Yarvin, Nick Land, people like that. The plan is, it seems to me, to do Naomi Klein, the shock doctrine, but on the most biggest scale you can possibly imagine. So that is a sort of multiple crisis with a financial crisis and a war, possibly even a world war. And of course, with the Chinese interests and the United States at each other's throats, that could even happen. You know, it's just not beyond the realm of possibility.
There's something I wanted to ask you. Where do you see China in all of this? China is a major productive power, outproducing the United States, producing products cheaper, better, and much, much faster than the United States is able to do. And I think that one of the players in the U.S. equation is a key person who I'd like to ask you your opinion of, and that is Elon Musk. Elon Musk is a person who came out of apartheid South Africa, came to Canada, is still a Canadian citizen, and then went to the United States, produced the electric car that was supposed to fight the global warming that the left was worried about. And he is now having his electric cars blown up by terrorists. The United States has declared people who blow up his cars.
I must interrupt you to say something about the electric cars. It seems obvious to me that there is a prediction of a war in the Middle East, which would mean the drying up of much of the world's oil supplies. And so we've got to have some, you know, sort of startup industry that's going to make a fortune out of that. Musk, definitely an accelerationist. He's one of these people. Basically, they are anarcho-capitalists, is what I describe them as. And they see the coming crisis, which they're engineering, as a great opportunity to dominate the outcome. Very much like, so for example, the Versailles conference dominated the outcome of the First World War. And Yalta dominated the outcome of the Second World War. They have their plans, and they know that they can't get these things through in a normal public debate of any sort, but they can when the world is on its knees. And that seems to me to be the object of much of what's going on now. This is what's called accelerationism. And it seems to me to be, you know, the idea is to accelerate the end of the world. And in a way, what you've got is a sort of tug of war, John, I think, between those on a more moral side that are pushing for justice to come out of this and love to be the outcome, and others who know that this crisis is going to happen, but they have decided that economic slavery and death is going to be the outcome with them in charge. So it's an all or nothing thing, I think, that's coming in our direction. I don't think the world has ever seen anything quite like it.
Neither have I, and I agree with you. I think that we are facing a challenge to everything we know, a challenge to our religious faith, a challenge to our faith in human beings to do the good thing for other human beings, and a challenge to each individual as to whether we're going to stand to the side and let them do it, or whether we're going to personally get involved to try to stop them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think we need to get together with others of faith. Now, I don't want to proscribe people's faith or prescribe it. But for me, it's important to understand that much of the church is compromised. I mean, from the Vatican, for example, right the way through to the financial priorities of much of the
Protestant church, I mean, myself, I'm a bit biased. I'm a nonconformist Quaker, and we came out of the English Civil War as really an alternative to the establishment church. But I think, you know, we need to get together with other people of faith to share our concerns, to share our love and care for others that see the things in a similar way to us. And also, of course, to those that don't see things.
I agree with you, you know. I wouldn't call myself a big Bible pounder, but I do believe in God, and I've come to believe in God more as I've grown older and seen things. And I can tell you, back in Serbia, where I was living before I came to Canada now, I've been in Canada almost a year now. I'm heading back to Serbia, but back in Serbia, the Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church was penetrated by CIA agents as a matter of course and as a priority, because the war empire wants to eliminate the churches as a possible impediment to the wars that they want to conduct. And they put a well-known CIA agent into the synod of our church. We had public debates about it, and there are others in the church who are there for financial reasons, and they are a major force inside the Holy Synod of the Serbian Orthodox Church. And I know that if they're doing it in such a conservative, small church as ours, they must be doing it in the big international churches around the world.
Well, the reason they're doing it is because the church is very much, I mean, politics is the head, if you want, the media and politics, and the church is the heart. They know the power that steering church debate can have. You know, so that, I think, is the main reason they do this. Very interesting to hear that. But I think much of the debate, I mean, for example, we had as our most recent Archbishop of Canterbury here in Britain, we had a guy who was an oil man. You know, suddenly he decides he's going to take up the cloth, and he becomes an oil man. And as soon as he started speaking out against the genocide, there's all sorts of problems with it, his management of child abuse cases, and suddenly he's booted out. So quite clearly, all of these major institutions, there's massive operations by God knows who, by, you know, the secret societies, for goodness sake, against these people, John. Anyway, look, I think we should just maybe finish with a little prayer for the future. And I hope you don't mind. I'd just like to say something along those lines. So, Heavenly Father, we just ask you this Easter that you guide those who are connected to you, your children, to expose the forces of darkness, and also to touch the hearts of those in power, steer them in the right direction, and to prick their conscience so that they can see your presence, as it's not necessarily an easy thing to do. I think a lot of people don't understand that they have to make the effort to meet God, to find God. And once they do, this can really transform their lives.
I take every word as you've given it, and I add my own. Amen.
John Bosnich, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you, Tony. Let's get the word out there.
The longer version of that interview with John Bosnich from Canada will be up on our show page later this evening. We do touch quite a lot on the sort of Eastery stuff at the end there, don't we? But anyway, it's a real wide-ranging look, particularly at Mark Carney and his role in the Bank for International Settlements in causing the 2008 bailouts financial crash. And this is all, of course, the idea is crash governments. Crash governments. That's what they're trying to do, so that the financial people are in charge. The Fourth Reich takes over with its big businesses, its big transnational corporations, many of them financed after World War II by Martin Bormann, Hitler's private secretary, the 750 companies which he rather sneakily put Jewish people in charge of, as often as chairman of the board, to disguise the fact that these massive transnational corporations were, or some of them much smaller, of course, when they first started, were actually all financed by Nazi money. Cheeky. Very, very, well, I mean, no, cheeky's too kind. This is evil, isn't it? It's evil incarnate. Finally, though, on Israel, Richard Medhurst here, chatting to Max Blumenthal recently, I thought was really good to see someone talking about this stuff, because we need to understand the Israeli prime ministers have got these kind of fake names. I think maybe it was George Galloway was on this too. But, this is a bunch of Europeans pretending to be from the Middle East, saying they're coming back to their own place. It's not theirs at all. More chutzpah.
Our friend Richard Medhurst found out something pretty interesting. And most of the prime ministers of Israel changed their name because they didn't sound Middle Eastern enough. You think I'm kidding? Let's watch a little bit of this.
I show you what I'm about to show you. Your mind will be blown. You're going to be blindsided. Every single Israeli prime minister has a fake name. Did you know that? I was just talking about Ben Gurion. Do you know what his original name is? It's Grun. Gruen. He changed it to make it sound more Jewish and sound more Middle Eastern. Do you know what Netanyahu's real name is? It's not Netanyahu. It's Milkovsky. I swear to God, go and look it up. You'll find Milkovsky. That's his real name. Remember what Israelis are. Israelis are European Jews. They don't come from Palestine, but they want to make believe and make you believe that they come from this area, that they are indigenous to the land, that they're so Jewish, right? Even though they have no connection. So they changed their names. Here's another one. Moshe Sharat. His name is Chertok originally. You've got Levi Eshkol. Eshkol was Shklonik. So he changed it from Shklonik to Eshkol. Then you have Yigal Alon. His original name, Pekovitz. Golda Meir, Israel's first female prime minister. Her real name is not Golda Meir. It's Mabovich.
Golda my ass.
More like mad bitch. We have Yitzhak Rabin, right? His name is not Rabin. It's Rubitzov. Are you seeing the pattern? These are Eastern European names. Not Palestinian, not Jewish, not Middle Eastern. They're Eastern European. Okay? They're not Palestinian. They don't come from this region. Yitzhak Shamir. He's a great one. You know, Yitzhak Shamir, he's on the wanted poster because he was wanted by the British police in Palestine for terrorism. But they don't tell you that. So Yitzhak Shamir, his original name is Yezernitsky. Shimon Peres. Persky. Netanyahu, I already told you, Malikovsky. I think I said Milkovsky, excuse me, it's Malikovsky. Never, you know, it's the same point. Ehud Barak is Brog. So B-R-O-G. Brog, he changed it to Barak. Ariel Sharon, his original name is Shinerman. He changed it to Sharon. And Yair Lapid, who's you still see him changing posts, his original name is Lampel. So he changed it from Lampel to Lapid.
Richard Medhurst, Max Blumenthal there. Why all Israeli prime ministers have fake names. Anyway, on to Todd Ryder now and the nuclear weapons and the nuclear stuff. Oh, God. It's amazing, really, this whole story should again be all over the news, a bit like Bob Gill earlier. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of people on here that you should do that with. But anyway, Todd is one of those that everyone should be hearing from, because his information is very, very solid, very well referenced. But the journalists and the editors don't care. Oh, no, it's too worrying. I don't really want to tell people that. I don't want to be the first, you know, useless morons. That's what you're there for. To be the first. It's called breaking news. It's called an exclusive, yeah? Remember? That's what people like Roland Perry used to do back in the 1990s in Fleet Street. But you're not doing any of that, are you? So this is Todd Ryder talking about something called the suborbital bomber, which the Nazis had been developing, called the Silverbird or the Supervogel. Basically a space shuttle that was being developed ready for testing at the end of the Second World War. And some of these, I mean, as he says, look, they've got engines for these things. They're building them. Never mind, it's not just some sort of sketch. Anyway, over to Todd Ryder with some of his most recent discoveries. And it was literally just earlier this week that an edition was added. And I'll put the full version up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk to this Hidden Histories Hidden History website in the States. It's basically a YouTube channel, but they hide the history. They don't even give the names or the subject matter that they're talking about. They need to be taught to write a headline, I think.
So in addition to the liquid propellant missiles, there were also liquid propellant space planes. So let's talk about those. You've already seen the winged A-9. This was even better. This was called the Silverbird, or Silbervogel in German, suborbital bomber. Very nice, catchy name. And they started working on this in 1933, very seriously, and continued all the way up to the very end of the war in 45. This was the brainchild of kind of the Austrian version of Werner von Braun, named Eugen Zenger, his wife, or later wife, Irene Brett. And so they designed what is basically a mini space shuttle. This would carry a pilot to guide it. It would carry a payload, and it would be launched from Germany. They were showing that these things could go potentially any place on the planet, drop their payload off any place on the planet. Just like the A-9 had the A-10 for a first stage, this would be launched by a first stage. Except the first stage was actually a rocket sled. So a very large rocket designed as a sled-type contraption on rails. And that first stage would stay on the rails use up all of its propellant give a very large boost to this mini space shuttle, which would be the second stage, and then had its own engine that would carry it up into space. So if you read the books, this is mentioned quite a bit in various history books and space books, but everybody says, oh, this was just a paper design. This was clearly so crazy. It was just a paper design. They could never do this. They could never get permission to do this. Purely a paper design. If it was purely a paper design, why do we have a photograph of its rocket engine? This is a photograph from the Deutsches Museum of this 100-ton thrust Silbervogel rocket engine in 1941. 4 years before the war ended. How far did they get by 1945? We have reports from post-war investigators, in this case, Canadian investigators, went to tour all the German rocket facilities after the war and said how impressed they were to see a rocket motor that was 10 times larger than the standard V2 or A4 rocket motor. That sounds like this thing. So they were making these giant rocket engines for something like the Silbervogel, the Silverbird. Still more reports. Once France was invaded by the Allies, they started finding more and more information about what Germany was building there on occupied territory, including this giant launch ramp, these rails I described. These were intended, according to the French people who are around, to launch these winged rockets and strike the United States. So intended to launch the Silbervogel. They're actually building the launch site, building the rails. Moreover, they added, the Germans had very helpfully told them, by the way, when we launch this thing, make sure you stand back 6 miles in case it accidentally detonates on the launch pad. So it was carrying a weapon with a blast radius of 6 miles. That is much more than a standard fission bomb. That is an H-bomb blast radius corresponding to the 6-ton bomb. So they were planning to launch the 6-ton bomb. They were working on the 6-ton bomb. They were building the launch ramps. They were building the engines for this thing. According to multiple sources, they were actually building the Silbervogel. So from reporters, Colonel, later General Donald Putt, they were building it. And so Putt, who led many Allied investigators after the war, captured many of these German engineers, was definitely in a position to know. He wrote in a journal the Germans had built a test version of this that carried one man and had landing gear. Test runs were made on the engine. And Putt was left wondering if they'd maybe even test launch this thing. He wasn't sure whether or not they'd actually test launch this thing, but they had built this. More information on that 6-ton bomb. This is from the designers themselves of that rocket, so Eugen Zenger and Irene Brett. So they wrote up a report with their calculations showing how their winged gizmo could be used for an attack on New York with a bomb load of 6 tons. Now, they were Austrian. They were doing a lot of this work in Austria. Here is another document from Austrian scientists. There was a very large Austrian group that was developing nuclear weapons during the war. It was led by a professor named Georg Stetter. So this is from someone who was very well acquainted with Stetter and the other people in his research group. And so after the war, he wrote, you know, it'd be really quite a shame if somebody were to set off a 6-ton bomb that has lithium hydride or lithium deuteride fusion fuel and has a fission bomb with uranium or plutonium to light the fusion fuel. It'd be quite a shame if somebody were to set off a 6-ton bomb like that overhead over, you know, some country. So, you know, gee, what could they have had in mind for their 6-ton payload here?
Todd, that's amazing. That describes exactly what eventually became the thermonuclear weapons.
Yes, exactly. Exactly. And indeed, there are a number of documents from the war or from investigators immediately after the war describing wartime German work on nuclear weapons using lithium hydride or lithium deuteride. And, you know, of course, after the war, Oak Ridge shifted and started doing isotope separation of lithium for lithium deuteride, just like that. In fact, there are documents during the war about German isotope separation of lithium during the war. They were separating lithium-6 and lithium-7 during the war. So this was much more than just a paper design. They had a very serious H-bomb program. And according to multiple sources, they got within perhaps several months of actually testing their H-bomb. So they were doing exactly what Oak Ridge, what so many people in the United States and the Soviet Union did after the war. But the U.S. and the Soviet Union perfected that in the 1950s. And here was Germany on the verge of perfecting it in 1945. And of course, the U.S. and the Soviet Union didn't have methods of delivering those H-bombs until the 1950s. But here is Germany, you know, perfecting or on the verge of perfecting delivery methods during the war. Even these two-man rockets, even a two-man spacecraft to carry this thing.
Todd Ryder there, this week's contribution on hidden history. And there he is talking about the Silverbird, amongst other things, the orbital bomber. This is mad, isn't it, to think of a pressurized aircraft that could go up into space that the Nazis had been developing. And of course, all this technology was then used as a bargaining chip at the end of the war. They realized they couldn't use these weapons to win the war, but they could use them to bargain with for after the war. Very clever. So also on a nuclear theme, we're going to hear now from a certain lady called Eileen Welsom, Welsome. Back in 1999, she wrote a book called American Secret Medical Experiments in the Cold War, The Plutonium Files. And here she explains that in the United States, just as if they were Nazis, funny that, isn't it? They were injecting patients, and I think in this case it's a black guy, with plutonium to see what it did to them, injecting them. They're telling them, well, we're going to give you an injection which is going to help you. But no, it was just plutonium they're injecting into their bodies. Amazing woman anyway, and she was won all sorts of awards back in the day. So let's have a listen now to Eileen Welsom speaking to Amy Goodman.
We're talking to Pulitzer Prize-winning reporter Eileen Welsom. So tell us about your discovery, how you made contact.
So I got out a map. I looked up Italy, Texas. It was south of Dallas, about 60 miles. I called directory assistance, got the number for Italy City Hall, called them up, introduced myself, described the person I was looking for, and they said, you're looking for Elmer Allen, but he died a year ago. Would you like his wife's number? So I said, of course, and I wrote the number down, and within minutes I was talking to Mrs. Allen.
And what did you say?
I was very circumspect because I didn't want to frighten her, and I didn't want to seem like a kook, and I also didn't want to put words in her mouth. I wanted to know what she remembered. So I just simply said that, you know, I had some documents that suggested that her husband may have been involved in a government-funded did study, and I would like to talk with her about it. And she asked me to talk to her daughter, Elmarine Allen Whitfield, and I called Elmarine, and Elmarine was very quiet on the phone as I reeled out my story, and then she said, okay, you can come on. And so I flew to Italy, Texas, and we sat down at Elmarine's kitchen table, and by the end of the interview, I knew, and they knew, that I had found the first of these 18 people.
Elmer's story?
Elmer's story.
What was Elmer's story? How did he end up in a hospital being injected with plutonium?
Elmer was a railroad porter. He and his wife were living in the Bay Area in the mid-1940s. They had gone out, they had left Texas, they had gone out there to start a better life. They had two young babies. Elmer fell from a train in Chicago and damaged his leg, and that sort of put him into the medical system. That was the beginning of his participation in this experiment. And his leg did not heal, and he kept going back to the doctor, and somehow he found himself in this clinic at UC San Francisco, University of California Hospital in San Francisco, and they selected him for this radiation experiment. And
but he didn't know that.
He absolutely did not know. He was told that he had an osteogenic sarcoma in his knee and that they were going to have to amputate in order to save him. There's some question about whether he did or didn't have that cancer, and I do not know the answer to that. But 3 days before they amputated that leg, they injected him in the calf intramuscularly with plutonium.
Didn't he describe to his wife how they sort of put a target on his leg and they injected it in the middle of that?
They eventually, with the consent of Mrs. Allen, I was able to get Elmer's medical records from UC San Francisco, and in those medical records, the doctors talked about putting that target on his calf prior to the injection.
Now, he never knew he was a subject in a U.S. government experiment, but he suspected something. Is that right?
Yes. He told a good friend of his in Italy, Texas, that the doctors kept flying in and out of his room practicing to be doctors. And he told his friend, they guinea pig me.
Yes, so a full version of that will be up on our show page at thisweek.org.uk. The book is The Plutonium Files, America's Secret Medical Experiments in the Cold War, by Eileen Welsom. Shocking stuff, isn't it? But it's not so shocking when you see that actually the Nazis were very connected with the Allies, weren't they? And I think really maybe it was only the Russians that really understood what was going on. Funny that, isn't it, that we now want to have a war with the Russians, according to Starmer and Tampon Charlie. Anyway, just to wind up this week, a couple of occultic things. We've got to do that on Good Friday, haven't we? The first one we're going to hear is from Halo Rock. That's around about 312 AD. This is when the Vatican was created. And the question that Halo Rock posed is it Christian or pagan?
So he built this ark in 312 AD, which was after he said he was Christian. I already mentioned the ark already, where I described how there's a bunch of eagles on it, but there's no Christian symbols on it. But this is what the ark looks like in Rome. It's still standing today. It's an amazing structure. I mean, it, like, when you see it in person, it's just like, what the heck? It's huge. All sorts of art is covering it. But if you look up close, it is a pagan symbol. I mean, I already talked about the triptych, right? In one of my old threads, the ancient religion of Freemasonry, the triptych is very important. Triptych is a larger center doorway with two on the side. the triptych is very symbolic to them. So that's a start. And then these four statues at the top, just wait until I describe to you what these four statues at the top represent. I talk about them soon. He has a message up here, which I will also talk about. And on the side of it, one of these circles is on the side, on one of the sides. And I'll show you what a picture of that is represents. But it's very symbolic, as you'll see, of the sun, the unconquered sun. Statuettes of Sol Invictus, the Roman sun god, appear in three places on the Ark of Constantine. So here's one of them right here. It's very pronounced on the side. So remember there's one on the side. It has just one massive piece of the sun god. You can see the four horses. You can see the sun god riding the horses. Apollo or Mithras, could be either one. And as you can see what I just showed you, the Ark does not have a statue at the top, right? But when he created it, it did have a statue. It had a bronze statue. And it was of Constantine riding four horses. A chariot of four horses. And what did I say? Remember what I said? That is exactly what the Roman sun god does. He rides a chariot of four horses. That's the sun god's symbol. So, yeah. At the very top of the Ark, it reads Instinctive Divinitatis, which means divinely inspired. So, he was divinely inspired by the sun god. There is no symbols, Christian symbols, on this Ark. So, he was divinely inspired by the sun god, not by Christian god. And just to, like, I mean, this is, why would he place that Ark there, right? Right next to the Colosseum. He placed it in a weird spot next to the Colosseum. But you have to remember, back in Rome, back in ancient Rome at the time, there was a massive, colossal statue of Sol Invictus. It was a massive statue. And it was also right next to the Colosseum. And that is where he placed the Ark. He placed the Ark right there. The main road of Rome used to run right through that main archway, the main road of Rome. So you would come, enter the city, go through Constantine's Ark. As you're going through the Ark, you would see this massive statue of Sol Invictus entering the city. Colosseum is on your right. You'd see the statue of Constantine at the top with the statues of him riding horses. All just telling you, worship the sun god. Welcome to Rome. So he placed it there on purpose. It was him saying, yes, I worship the sun god.
Finally tonight, let's have a listen to a guy I'm a big fan of, actually. His book, Born in Blood, is absolutely amazing. And it's all about how the Knights Templar became the Freemasons. And he is a Freemason himself, so he should know. John J. Robinson, a book is Born in Blood. But here he is talking about Catholic Masons, because we're often told, oh, well, Catholics are not allowed to be Masons. Maybe, maybe not.
I would like to ask your guest to comment on two things. One, secret organizations in the Catholic Church, particularly the Knights of Columbus.
Why the Knights of Columbus? To me, I always thought Knights of Columbus was just the Catholic version of the Masons.
Well, as a matter of fact, you're right. It was formed by a Father McGivney in Hartford, Connecticut, to give the young men of his parish an alternative to Freemasonry, since Catholics weren't allowed to join.
Yeah, but, you know, I used to be Catholic, or I guess you're being like a Jew. Once you're a Catholic, you're always a Catholic. But
yeah.
to me, all the Knights of Columbus guys did is have a big time and drink.
Well, inside, they had private meetings. They had first, second, and third degree. In World War One, they added a fourth degree based on patriotism. But the church didn't object to them as a secret society because there's a priest attached to every chapter of the Knights of Columbus, so they had no secrets from the church. But there are other secret societies. There's a Catholic secret society that is operating around the world and in America today called Opus Dei. Means is Latin for the work of God. They have the extraordinary thing that at their initiation, they are handed a brown bag that contains a short piece of knotted rope and a spike chain. And with the rope, they are to beat themselves every Saturday, the day before their Sabbath, to beat out sinful thoughts.
Oh.
And the spike chain is to wear around the leg under your clothing. And it has a screw that can be used to tighten it so that it creates pain with every step.
Oh.
And if your mind needs cleansing real bad, you can tighten it up so that it hurts worse.
Boy, what does the Pope think of that?
He is, so far, all in favor of it.
That sounds like those guys in Iran with the Ayatollah. They used to beat themselves with chains.
So there are elements of the church who, you know, still believe in self-flagellation.
Well, there is an additional organization, I believe, called P2.
P2 was kind of a nickname or an abbreviation in Italy and in Europe. Propaganda meant public relations, in a sense. And there was a lodge called Propaganda Due, which is P2.
Which several popes have belonged to.
So that's the author of Born in Blood, John J. Robinson, which has absolutely got to be on your bookshelf. A real physical book, not some sort of electronic thing that might be hacked and various words taken out. Oh, my God. Don't ask. So that, and I'll put a full version of that up on our show page, that interview with him, later at thisweek.org.uk. This week's ode is Naming Names. The truth is out there. Oh, what a journey one must take to find the truth or truth forsake. In heart a feeling one may get when learning of another threat. Truth from sleuths or those who say, believe our words, we are the way. So many names, so many views of choices, voices for us to choose. From airwaves came a kindly voice, Richie Allen, what a choice. The COVID years he helped us through, Judge Neapolitano too. Scott Ritter, oft an angry man, who tells us how it is, the plan. Wolf and Hudson, what a pair, two learned men with facts to share. Celente shouts, is often cross, but views he has are never dross. Anti-war and anti-vax, true views from Jimmy Dore, attacked. Neil Oliver oft has his say, low profile keeps, but seems okay. Libor, Adam on banks and scams, on genocide, a go-to man. John Waters, true blue journalist, spoke out, was quashed, and truth was missed. Alex Craner, Escobar, Pepe's words and truth go far. Bill Cooper on conspiracy. Ahead of time, Sutton, Anthony. Troy Kennedy Martin wrote Zed Gars, Bent Cops, and Britain Broke, as well as O'Reilly Ace of Spies. So many souls of good we know, so many more will come and go. In heart a feeling one may get when reading, hearing, or watching Vet. Top tip, dear listener, keep wits about. Help sow the seeds of truth in drought. Notwithstanding, Tony G, Martin S, and Dave, the B. Politics each Friday views with Not the BC FM News, where voices raised and thoughts expressed and friendships oft put to the test. But after all is said and done, the truth is heard with lots of fun. That's lovely. Thank you, Patricia. So that's all for today. It's a war on God, but God's going to win. Time to sign off. Thanks ever so much to all the guests we've had over the last few weeks, years, but particularly those who have been helping us since we were made homeless by the trans lobby. That was a bit annoying. You can download MP3s to listen in the car or anywhere you like and follow Tony Gosling Censored on Telegram. Do please send me interviews and story tips on the Telegram channel via Not the BCFM Politics Show page. I'm on Twitter at Tony Gosling, but of course it's shadow banned. And in fact, I noticed the other day that Elon Musk is saying, oh, if you want to boost your post, you can pay me. Oh, really? That's funny, isn't it? So you have shadow banned me so that my posts are reduced. But in order to get anywhere close to getting a proper service from Twitter or X, you've got to pay. Bribe. In other words, Elon Musk. My paperbacks about deals between Churchill and the Nazis at the end of World War II, The Traitors of Arnhem, Martin Bormann and the Bilderberg Group, that costs £15. That's a real book. Also, my secret government anthology from Cromwell to the Princess Diana assassination, that's called The Siege of Heaven Reader. They're both on eBay. You'll find The Siege of Heaven ebook with my RT articles, plus my most recent John Dee and the Empire, all at www.bilderberg.org. This show's repeated at 11 p.m. Fridays and at 11 and 5 a.m. p.m. all week on the talkradio.org.uk stream, the website for this program, where all this wonderful stuff happens and the downloads, etc. If you haven't got the app, is thisweekoneword.org.uk. Have a relaxing and enjoyable Easter. Do please join us for Not the BCFM Politics Show next Friday at 5. God bless. And don't let the synagogue of Satan get you down.
The first lesson is written in the prophecy of Isaiah in the 63rd chapter, beginning at the first verse. The prophet speaks of God's judgment, but also of his mercy and love. Who is this that comes from Edom, from Bozrah, in garments stained crimson? Who is this so splendidly robed, marching in his great might? It is I, announcing vindication, mighty to save. Why are your robes red and your garments like theirs who tread the winepress? I've trodden the winepress alone, and from the peoples no one was with me. I trod them in my anger, and I trampled them in my wrath. Their juice spattered on my garments and stained all my robes. For the day of vengeance was in my heart, and the year for my redeeming work had come. I looked, but there was no helper. I stared, but there was no one to sustain me. So my own arm brought me victory, and my wrath sustained me. I trampled down peoples in my anger. I crushed them in my wrath, and I poured out their lifeblood on the earth. I will recount the gracious deeds of the Lord, the praiseworthy acts of the Lord, because of all that the Lord has done for us, and the great favor to the house of Israel, that he's shown them according to his mercy, according to the abundance of his steadfast love. For he said, surely they are my people, children who will not deal falsely. And he became their savior in all their distress. It was no messenger or angel, but his presence that saved them. In his love and in his pity, he redeemed them. He lifted them up and carried them all the days of old. Here ends the first lesson.
And if we draw some water, does the well run dry?
Tired and ill, as I come back, would you? seems to drift far away now. Nothing is quite what it seems. Sometimes entangled in your own dream. And we can experiment further still. Well, thanks to our kindness and skill, you have no trouble until you catch your breath and the nurse will present you the bill.